The Legislative Commission on Pensions will come to order. First order of business will be the four hospital bills, privatization bills we were talking about last, I guess, on Wednesday. Are you going to handle it, or Vanek? Ms. Vanek? Topic in general, you were going to talk with the actuaries, and where are we?
Mr. Chair and members, Mary Vanek, PERA Executive Director. I spoke with the actuary retained to consult with the commission, and she calculated based upon our funded ratio that we could offer an additional 4% and 6% augmentation rather than the 5.5% and 7.5%. However, I discussed with Senator Pogemiller that I feel compelled that we should grant the current provisions to the four groups currently going through because there were expectations raised. Two of the groups have completed their actuarial analysis, paid for those studies. Another group has paid for half of it and is underway. And the fourth group was told by us that privatization was the option rather than staying in PERA. But then following these four groups, we would then close out the current enhanced augmentation features and put in a 4 and 6%, which is more affordable for the plan.
Okay, so members understand where we're headed here? Okay, Senator, who's the first one here? Renvilla. Representative Smith moves the Renvilla provisions. I think we have that one in technical shape. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Motion adopted. We have Hutchinson. Is that the next one? Did we adopt?
We adopted the A89 amendment, Mr. Chair.
So does that get us where we need to be with just the A89?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Senator Bedsell moves Senate File 1091, House File 1100 as amended. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion adopted. Bridges. What town is that in? Ada.
Ada.
Who's up north here? Anybody? Senator Larson moves the Senate File 1149, House File 1808. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted. Northfield. Who's down there? Anybody?
I'm over there.
Representative Wardlow is about as close as we can get to Northfield. He moves Senate File 1352 or House File 920. Discussion. Now, do we need to add an amendment?
The 68 has been adopted.
The 068 has been adopted. So as amended, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Okay, thank you, Ms. Vanek. And I think Ms. Vanek and her actuaries and the Pension Commission staff are going to kind of work on this over the interim so that we can kind of reset our policy on this matter to kind of align the funding ratios when folks are allowed to do this. So I think the way to describe this is that those are the last four that are kind of going through that door, and we need to adjust the policy. Okay, Senator Bedsold and Smith, 995 and 1206. Mr. Martin? I think we have to make a... Lisa, why don't you tell us the technical issue here?
Members, in your packets, the numbered tabs after the first item are all one number off. Item 3 is actually item number 2 on the agenda. The item marked number 4 is actually number 3. Happy April Fool's.
God. Okay, Mr. Martin.
Members, we've consolidated the discussion on both Senate File 995 and Senate File 1206. onto one memo. They relate to the same policy area, and that's the general limitation that's on all salary that's covered for our retirement purposes that can be found in Minnesota Statute Section 356.611. And this may sound familiar. The commission spent some time on this topic last year when we discovered or was discovered that the there was non-compliance or non-enforcement with the general salary cap. This is the cap that's set at 95% of the governor's salary. What happened during legislation last year is that some additional exceptions to the cap were added to Section 356.611. The bills that you have before you would add additional exceptions to the cap. Senate File 995 adds five exceptions. At this point, you might want to flip to the top page of the staff memo rather than the summary. There are the two summaries there, and the five that are added in the Senate File 995 House File 2109 bill are a constitutional officer other than the governor, four county attorneys, some upper positions in the Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, two positions at the League of Cities, and the manager of a utility organization, Utilities Plus, which is the former Blue Earth Power. Senate File 12006, House File 1250, adds a single exception, but a broad one, which would be any elected official of a political subdivision. So this potentially would apply to county attorneys, county sheriffs, and so forth.
Anybody want to testify?
Members of the commission. Good morning. How are you? My name is Sandy Naren. I'm appearing here today on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association.
Can we have to speak? That one doesn't amplify, so you kind of have to speak up.
Sorry. Sandy Naren. I'm appearing here today on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association and the Minnesota Sheriffs Association. And I'm here speaking on behalf of Senate File 1206, House File 1250, which is the second bill in the packet. What that bill does is exempt all local elected officials from the provisions of 356.611. The memo that pension staff has put together describing this situation and how this law originally passed back in 1994 do a very good job of summarizing what the original intent of this law was when you passed it back then. What they say in their memo here talks about the salary padding attempt by a quasi-public employee back then and your attempt to address that situation. The memo that Mr. Martin and staff have put together say that the commission was concerned about the potential for salary abuses in pension plan coverage where the salary setting process is not subject to the public salary setting procedures generally applicable to government. County attorneys and sheriffs are local elected officials whose salaries are clearly set by elected bodies in open meetings. They were never discussed as people who would be, as a group who would be included in this back when this provision was passed by the Pension Commission 10 years ago. I was at all those hearings, and it was never the intent to include any of these kinds of groups. Last year, the legislature addressed part of this situation by excluding all state employees, like judges and certain MNSCU employees who were also inadvertently brought into this through the drafting of this law back in 1994. This is part two of this now. Local officials were not addressed during last year's fix, and so we are here today to respectfully request that you address the local employees who clearly were not intended to be included in this cap when you passed this law 10 years ago.
Questions? Thank you, Ms. Naren.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug Carnival, representing Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, and but be very brief, Mr. Chair. This bill just simply adds in those people who last year were in the Senate bill who did not end up in the conference committee report. And as you see, some of the ones last year that were approved, in addition to the ones that Ms. Nieren pointed out, were the Gillette Hospital employees, the Crop Insurance Council, and the Minnesota Historical Society. This just simply adds those back in that that were in the Senate bill that that did not make it. I've spoken with Ms. Fanick, and she indicates that there's no opposition from the PERA and that they're neutral on the position on the bill. So I'd urge your support.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Carnival. What? I just don't know about the Municipal Power Agency, did you say?
Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy, Representative Murphy, yes.
What position does, if we don't pass this, what position is under the law?
The salary above the limit would not be able to be counted for contributions to the pension plan.
But how does it, is it because it's a municipal power company that is in the plan in the first place?
Yes, it's a municipal power agency.
So they get public money?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, it's an agency that's the wholesale power supplier to a number of municipal utilities throughout the state, mainly in southern Minnesota, but I think one as far as north as Grand Marais for members. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Larson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Carnival, what kind of salaries do these gentlemen have now? What's the top salary, and what are the other salaries that are executives?
Mr. Chair, I have a consultant here who works with the agency that has that information. If I can ask him to come forward, Mr. Binet.
Members might refer to page 3-2, number 4. It specifically talks about the Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm Al Bonnet from the Hay Group, and the Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency is one of my clients. The question, Mr. Chairman, Senator Larson.
Tell me what the top salaries are in the organization right now.
I haven't committed them to memory, but the top salary, I believe, is 160-some thousand.
160?
We've done some studies on behalf of the agency, looking at the organizations with which they compete in the utility industry, and that is actually considerably below the median for jobs of the complexity of the head of the Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency.
So, Mr. Chairman, is there a PERA retirement based then on that salary as part of their high five then?
my understanding is that the PERA contributions are limited to the governor's salary cap. And the issue here is, would it be possible to credit the full amount of compensation for pension calculation purposes and pension contribution purposes under PERA?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Martin, can you kind of give us an update on how that works? So they're limited right now to 95% of the governor's pay as far as retirement is concerned?
Members, yes. The current statute sets a limit for some public employees and quasi-public employees in Minnesota at 95% of the governor's salary. That's 114 and some odd thousand at the moment. I have a chart of the salary increases of the governor, and I do include the Compensation Commission recommendations. This would be right following item the Appendix B in your packet. So it's about two-thirds of the way, halfway through your packet. There'll be a one-page sheet that has an awful lot of numbers on a landscape basis, and that will give you the salaries, both current, past, and what's proposed by the Compensation Council for the governor and other individuals in state government. But the governor is the driving salary for this particular limit.
Mr. Chairman, so they are limited, the pension contributions are limited to 95% of the governor's salary.
Senator, yes, unless there's an exemption in law, and school employees are exempted broadly, hospital employees are exempted broadly, and various other individuals by virtue of reference to a employee relations statute are exempted. There are also some exemptions that were added last year as part of the final omnibus pension bill deliberations. Those were the Historical Society, the Crop Improvement Association, and some others. The memo does lay out the total group.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Martin, it'd be nice if we had some facts and figures about what the potential retirement would be. I mean, if some of these salaries are $250,000 and you get into the high five, that's a pretty high retirement. And I know we've got members of TRA up to $14,000 a month. We got 25 of them over $9,500 a month. So, these are all pretty good retirement plans, and that's fine. But I think to take the cap off of the 95%, there are other ways that they can contribute to retirement plans. There's lots of different ways, but this gets to be a local government contribution level, which really gets, I think, out of whack. So could we get some figures, Mr. Chairman, about what the potential retirement benefits might be in some of these cases? Because I think it's getting... Some of the regular employees are not very happy about this because they're kind of at the bottom of the barrel, and some of these top executives are getting fantastic retirements, and I'd like to have some figures on that before we act on any of these bills.
Mr. Martin?
Senator, the staff doesn't have the necessary data,
no.
So we would have to ask the pension funds. As kind of a rough way of calculating this, the benefit for someone who retires at 65 would be 1.7% of their high five. So a member with 30 years of service would get 51% of their high five. Their high five is about 90% of their final salary. So if you can do those mental computations, take the final salary times 90% times about 51%, you're going to get a 30-year employees' benefits.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman,
we will ask the various pension funds.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, if Mr. Martin would do that, he could get the information from the pension fund. So I think we should have those figures before we act on any of these bills.
Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chairman, I think as we have the discussion, we should probably keep a little the history of how the reason for this law in mind. There were some abuses in the 80s. That caused the legislature to say that they should cap off some benefits, not only in salaries and in pensions, at 95% of the governor's salary, at a time when the governor's salary was considered so far away from anyone else that, you know, it was just not attainable. But over the years, the governor's salary has not increased commensurate to what some of the other salaries have. And the governor's also has other perks, a free house and so forth, that are not normally included with other government employees. So I think that's one of the reasons why we're running into the problem here, because we have not kept the governor's salary at pace with the other ones, and they're catching up to them, and that's why we are finding ourselves in this dilemma right now.
Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment because we have the Port Authority at Duluth, and Representative Murphy would know about that. We have the largest port on the Great Lakes up at Duluth, and we have the lowest paid port director. So I would like to have Mr. Martin have an amendment that this group would include the port director for the Port of Duluth.
Okay. Which way do you want to go, Senator Larson? You want to put more people in, or you
No, I want to put them in, but I want to limit their retirement to 95% of the governors. So I want to put them in the salary.
Okay.
Exclude them from the cap.
Thank you. Anybody else want to testify?
Mr. Chair, members of the Commission, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. If I could just try to explain the situation about this cap issue, there are two state statutes that govern this. 43A.17 is the 95% governor's salary cap that actually affects compensation. 356.611 is the statute that mirrors that 95% in the pension law. The problem is that some people are not covered by the 43A.17 95% governor's salary cap, but they are, due to the construct of 356.611, covered by the 95% pension cap. We've looked at this, and we support Senate File 995, but we also think that that you could end this problem by amending the statute more generally, and we've talked with Representative Smith about a more general amendment that would cover situations like Senator Larson raised with the additional individual that may be covered by this. So I just leave that as another option. There is an amendment draft that was not in the packet, but that Representative Smith does have.
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, before I make my comments, I need to disclose that I would be affected personally by potential amendments to this. If that's going to cause concern with the committee, I certainly ask that you specifically write me out. Following up on Mr. Carlson's comments and some of the comments made before, this issue has been before the commission before. All state employees were specifically accepted from this cap last year. All school district employees were also accepted from this cap this year. Non-school local governments are essentially the only entities that remain subject to this cap. With specific respect to counties, Senate File 995 provides an exception for four county attorneys from the counties of Anoka, Dakota, Ramsey, and St. Louis. Since this bill has been drafted, the Olmsted County attorney is now also over the current 43A17 actual salary cap, and I would suggest should also be covered by these bills. In the future, I believe it is likely that more county attorneys, as well as possibly county sheriffs, are going to be subject in this same situation. So, again, to concur with Mr. Carlson's comments, we don't think it's really a good use of your time or ours to come back here every year as additional people come affected by this constraint and ask that you put in a more generic provision as contained in the language that Representative Smith has an amendment.
Questions?
Senator
Larson.
Mr. Chairman, to both you gentlemen, I'm not opposed to taking the cap off. I am opposed to taking the cap off the 95% for retirement purposes of the governor. So what's your position on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Larson, for the positions for the League of Minnesota Cities, we would support taking that 95% pension cap off. It seems like an artificial constraint on the ability to compensate the individuals for the services provided.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, if I understand, you say you are not opposed to the actual salary cap being taken off. If that's taken off, then this issue becomes moot. There would be no cap for either pension purposes or the payment of the actual salary itself.
But, Mr. Chairman, it seems to me, the 95% cap is a reasonable one. And if the local units of government, whoever, want to enhance the retirement for that particular position, that gives you more flexibility in doing that rather than having everybody under the eliminated from the 95% cap. Wouldn't that make sense?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, in all frankness, our organizations are lobbying for removal of the 95% cap in 43-17 because it's causing a significant difficulty for us in attracting people for our top management and professional positions. So we oppose the cap in 43-17 on the current local government's explicit salaries, as well as opposing it in relationship to this. This is not of the positions that would be covered by this a substantial financial issue. I believe the top individual who would be covered would be somewhere in the range of in the $130,000 range. Most of them are closer to $120,000, so we're only talking about a few thousand dollars of additional salary being covered by the pension contributions and taken into account for setting their benefits.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Martin, did you draft this amendment here?
This is the one that Representative Smith had drafted up. Just for information purposes, how does this one work, Larry?
Members, this is drafting language that Mr. Carlson gave us, yes. What this does is it adds one more exemption, or it actually replaces the various exemptions in the bill that are newly added with a more generic exemption for any employee or elected official who is not subject to the limit in the employee relations statute 43A.17. So the League of Cities, other entities that are not covered by the 43A statute but also not be covered by the general salary limit for pension purposes statute 356.611.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, can I just point out that I'll partially to address Senator Larson's concern, none of these amendments, whether we're talking about the bills or the amendments that has just been placed before you, would affect the other cap that ties the limit to federal law that I believe is very roughly in the neighborhood of $210,000. That's in the second subdivision of this statute. I'm not sure if it's actually referenced in the if it's contained in the bill or not.
No,
there's a
not.
Second subdivision.
No. Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Larson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm still concerned about this. And is there an actuarial cost to this? What are the additional contributions that that the cities and local units of government have to make to these pension plans?
We'll get the funds up here. Anybody? Any other questions for the two local?
Mr. Chair, just briefly, when this last year when we got into this and we basically exempted out the individuals we knew about it, we had some the individual who presented to us at the time was that the individuals, including for instance Ed Burdick, the now retired clerk of the House, were making contributions in excess of the pension that they could have been receiving, and of course they expected their pension was going to be at a certain level. And these individuals, by retiring and being affected by the cap, would have simply had their contributions refunded to them and gotten a lower pension as a result of exceeding the cap. So there weren't any actual costs. It's just that they were paying more into their pension than they were allowed to get back for their benefits.
But, Mr. Chairman, at that point, they had an option to take their cash out, too.
Well, but, of course, they didn't want to take their cash out because they've been contributing all these years thinking that they're contributing to their pension when, in fact, they were just sending their money, to the government that was going to send it right back to them without any effect on their pension. And that didn't make a lot of sense.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Ms. Vanek, any of the other funds want to testify on this?
Mr. Chair and members, Mary Vanek, PERA Director. I did not ask the PERA board to take a position on this because really it's an issue of what are the appropriate levels of salary to be paid to local government officials and employees. I'd like to raise a couple of points, and if you would indulge me.
A clarification that I was just wondering about. In effect, this only does affect PERA now because we've exempted. and Minneapolis teachers, but we've exempted everybody who would be under TRA or MSRS. Is that a correct? Okay.
That's correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to point out that PERA has monitored salaries every year since this law passed. And we have been refunding overpayments to most individuals until probably the last 4 or 5 years. There are 10 to 12 individuals who have been trying to work through the Department of Employee Relations and the subcommittee to seek waivers. We have flagged their accounts. They have been told that their benefit will only be calculated on the 95% cap unless they resolve the issue. So, Senator Larson, that is not a concern from Paris' perspective. We have monitored this very closely and communicated with the employers and the individuals affected on a regular basis. Secondly, Mr. Carlson did, Keith pointed out that there is a cap by federal law, so we will continue to monitor whether you lift this, eliminate this cap on the state level or not, because we still have to comply with federal law. Federal law says this year it's $210,000 on which we can accept contributions and calculate pensions. That is only increased when inflation increases that amount by an additional $5,000. So it remains at 210 until the inflation factor brings it up to a higher level. The board has not taken a position on this bill. As I said, they had the discussion that this whole issue of salary caps was not a big deal when we sought the legislation to correct the individual who was abusing the system in 1994. I did the audit myself that year. There were 13 individuals who exceeded the salary cap, and they were all exempted because they were hospital physicians. Now, granted, we had 160 individuals on the audit report for 2003. So it clearly indicates that it's becoming an increasing issue where there is a glass ceiling, so to speak, for salaries to advance for local government employees and elected officials covered by PERA.
Ms. Vanek, so you're auditing these retirement accounts as they come forth. Now, you've been doing that on your own without under TRA, we had put some language in last session to have the TRA audits made because many of the school districts were submitting, we think, not accurate information on what the high five average was because they're putting in severance pay and lots of other issues which built up their high five retirement. And I don't know, Mr. Thompson, would you tell us what's happening there, Mr. Chairman? I'd just like to know what's happening with TRA and how you're auditing TRA regarding some of these factors we're talking about.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Senator Larson, yes, we are auditing those. We always did it. We did submit a report on the ones that did exceed it that we made adjustments to. I believe there were three superintendents in that report.
Mr. Chairman, I can't hear you, Mr. Thompson.
I'm sorry.
Just so you know, these don't really amplify in this room. You just have to speak up.
Okay.
That's all.
Yes, we are auditing those as required by the legislation that was passed last year. We did submit a report on the ones that we did reduce their salary because they had some inadmissible salaries in there. Namely, it was the car allowance, severance pay, things of this nature. There were three of those that we did include in the report to the commission. There is an issue. I mean, we do audit it. We have found that the employers don't necessarily report to us the correct allowable salary. And so that is a big issue for us. We go back. We reduce those, their allowable salary for pension purposes, and we do get, a lot of criticism for that. But.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I know as author of that provision, I think that was important, and you've found three cases in which they've been adding inaccurate figures?
Yes, there were three cases. I believe it was three cases where we reduced their salary for pension purposes because of inadmissible salary in there.
Well, Mr. Chairman, congratulations. We knew this was going on for a long time, and I hope that you continue to audit those retirement requests vigorously.
Mr. Chair, I apologize to confuse the issue a little more here, but if the amendment that was just distributed, 195, were to pass, my concern that I'm going to raise right now wouldn't be an issue. But there were two individuals that PARA didn't name last year in the laundry list of, that's included in the bill you're considering, and those are Regents Hospital nurses. We have been working with Regents, the successor of St. Paul Ramsey, throughout this last decade on this salary issue. And Regents was successful in going to the Department of Employee Relations and the subcommittee and specifically excluding some positions from the cap. But last year, the commission and then the legislature affirmed excluding all Gillette Hospital employees who were allowed to stay in MSRS, but who are the new ones aren't coming in. So we'd like to protect those Regents Hospital nurses also, who we have put on notice that they will receive a refund of the additional contributions at retirement if this isn't fixed for them.
Okay,
let's get a slight clarification here. If we took the 195, Mr. Martin, just why don't you explain the conversation with these
two. Members, as I understand the circumstance, if you did 195, you would exempt individuals who are in quasi-governmental enterprises, the Municipal Power Organization, League of Minnesota Cities, and so forth, because they're not subject to the limit that's in 43A.17. The individuals who are still covered by that employee relations cap on their actual salary are local government employees. And there are, according to information we got last year from PERA, some individuals in local government that do receive salaries greater than the current limit. They do have a mechanism to get an exemption.
That list is on page 5.
Right. Right.
That list is on page 5 of the memo. Okay, there's a mechanism now. Go ahead.
So, members, as I understand this, the broad group of quasi-governmental entities would be exempted en masse by the 195 amendment, and because there's an existing mechanism for local government employees who are actually covered by this cap still, they can seek on an individual case basis an exemption from the 43A.17 limit, and they would automatically get an exemption from the 356.611 limit that we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Vanek, is that the situation? Has anybody gained that exemption through the employee relations process?
Yes.
And who would that be?
Members, I'm not sure I can lay out who they are, but in going
what
through the list, there were 6 or 8 that I saw readily.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, there have been approximately 54 requests for exemption from the cap through the process in 43A.17. Approximately 36 have been granted. And those, again, are not subject to this cap. Whatever their salary was allowed to rise above the 43A.17 is the salary that is used for purposes of determining their pension contribution and their benefit.
Could you give us a sense of who what positions were those 36?
Mr. Chairman, members, it was several positions within Hennepin County, within the city of Minneapolis. There were several suburban city managers. Before, the hospitals were specifically written out of the law back 2 or 3 years ago. There were several hospital-type positions that were written out of the that were granted specific exceptions. That's now a moot issue because the statute in general. And I think that the St. Louis County, Dakota County, Anoka County, and Olmsted County have received exemptions for one or more positions in addition to Hennepin County. Ramsey is, and Washington counties are two of the counties who have requested exemptions but not received them.
And are you aware of there were 36 ACOT exemptions out of 40.
Approximately.
Out of 45 or 8 or something?
About 54 with a number of requests.
Who's in the group 36 to 54 that didn't get them? Why, and why didn't they get them?
Mr. Chairman, members, Minneapolis requested exceptions for a wide range of positions. A number of those were turned down. So they both received exemptions for some positions, I believe the coordinator, the assistant coordinator, the police chief, the fire chief, a number of other positions were denied. I can't, in all frankness, I don't believe there's any rhyme or reason to their process because the same individual who was granted an exemption in his former position as the St. Louis County Administrator was denied an exemption in his position as Ramsey County Administrator, obviously a much bigger county. And I would make the same case with regards to the Washington County Administrator when his counterparts in somewhat similar jurisdictions, Anoka and Dakota, were granted exceptions. It just depends on the whims of the current administration, in all frankness.
For a further explanation of that, Mr. Hubinger, is it something beyond whims? Go. Mr. Hubinger.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and I also staff the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. Under the law, a local government can apply for a waiver from the cap. The law requires that the commissioner grant the waiver, but before he can do that, he has to request advice from the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. The standard in the law requires that the position that the employer needs to provide a higher salary in order to attract or retain a qualified employee. And so the question is whether the market conditions are such that you need to have a higher salary in order to retain a current employee, generally is the case. There were a number of positions several years ago where the city of Minneapolis applied for waivers. I think there were like eight in one shot. And the market data didn't support granting a waiver, and so those were turned down. About half of them were granted. The current commissioner has applied a stricter standard about what market conditions exist in the state in terms of attracting or retaining a county administrator, and as such has turned down a number of requests in the last 24 months.
It turned down even though a recommendation by the subcommittee was that it should be an exemption?
Mr. Chair, there's something of a mixed bag. Under the law, the commissioner only needs to request the advice of the subcommittee if he's inclined to grant a waiver. If he doesn't intend to do that, he doesn't have to seek the subcommittee's advice.
Mr. Chairman, if I could add, the commissioner has gone against the recommendations of the commission in several instances that we went through. The commission suggested an
commissioner
increase.
I'm unclear. Who is it again?
The Subcommittee on Employee Relations makes a recommendation to the Commissioner of Employee Relations.
Right. Okay.
And as Mr. Carlson indicated, there have been a number of cases in the last 24 months where the subcommittee has recommended a waiver to grant a higher salary and the commissioner has declined.
Mr. Chair.
Subcommittee on Employee Relations is legislators from the House and the Senate.
Mr. Chair, there are five members from the House and five from the Senate.
Okay. Senator Michelle.
That was my question.
Are they designated positions, leadership positions, or it's just a group that's been chosen by the House and the Senate?
Chosen by the majority leader.
But it's not designated people like the finance chair and it's not designated.
Mr. Okay. Chair, no.
Anybody on that sitting here? Anybody ever been on it?
I've been on it.
Is it a good group usually?
Yes. and they make very fine decisions usually.
So if that group has made that decision and the commissioner chooses not to follow it, you would say that perhaps that's something we ought to factor in here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Whim was a good word.
So you agree with Mr. Carlson's characterization of this? Right. You didn't mean by the legislative commission. You meant whim by the doer. Okay. But there is criteria.
They didn't have, at the time I was on it and we were talking about, all the criteria was not known. to everyone, I don't think.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks for being here, Mr. Hubinger. Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair and members, I'd just like to offer what I discussed with our Board of Trustees. The federal limit is there. We always have to follow the federal limit. Mr. Martin raises in the staff memo that there are states that limit the growth in the salary in the final year's calculation. And that's the direction that the board and I were going to discuss in the future if this doesn't get resolved or if there's further study of it. I don't necessarily agree with the recommended 106% in the staff amendment because our assumed growth in the final years, later ages of our members is already an underlying 5%. But we do think it's reasonable. There's some states that do 8, there's some states that do 20. So basically it says that in the final years that you use in calculating your pension from year to year or 2 years to 4 years, you can't see X percent growth in excess of this. It has to be within that limit. The problem that we have yet to figure out is how you address actual promotion. For example, say I had worked in my position as a manager in para until 2 years before I want to retire, and then I'm appointed as executive director, and the board would appoint me at the highest level of salary for the director. I would have received an incredibly large increase in salary. So you can't discount true promotions. We'd have to work that out, but I think that is an option if the salary cap is lifted for both salary and pension purposes, that there are still ways to control what you would, what you could perceive as abuses in sweetening the high five salary.
How is it? I don't mean to sound like a naive question, but if you're paying in the appropriate amount to receive out a certain benefit, how is that how can that be characterized as an abuse? Whatever, because it's your high five, all right? So you got a promotion, you got a salary increase, and that's the last 2 or 3 years of your – you're still paying in whatever it takes to get the benefit.
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely right. But where you have an issue is when, for let's say you're a 30-year career employee, right, and you've had a low salary and the assumptions have been that your salary is going to increase maybe 7% a year in your early years, okay, and 5% later. Well, then in your last 5 years, all of a sudden you receive a 50% increase in salary. We haven't accounted for that kind of growth in salary.
So in that sense, you probably haven't paid the amount necessary to cover your benefit. Okay. Questions, Senator Larson?
Yeah. Well, yeah, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Vanek, I think the thing that kind of bothers me we're talking about performance and accountability in government, and it just seems to me if we limit the pension to 95%, there is nothing to prevent a local unit of government or a school board to set up a program which would be helpful and would be an incentive for those people to perform according to what their expectation of that job was. And I go to your position now as a member heading up PRA and MSRS and TRA. How does your salary relate to the cities of the first class regarding executive directors?
Mr. Chair, Senator Larson, the statewide fund director's salaries are limited to 85% of,
yes,
the governor's salary, and none of us are at the maximum at this point in time. But, that's neither, from my perspective.
No, I understand that, Mr. Chairman, but this is an unfair system. It's an unfair system, and that's why I'd like to have some continuity in the retirement. And if the municipal board of Rochester or I always get a kick out of the judges because we have an opening in Fergus Falls. We have 11 applicants, and then once they get to be a judge, not these particular people, but then they're not paid enough money, and you have all these applications for these judgeships, and then they complain about their salary and retirement. So it's just kind of frustrating for me, Mr. Chairman. We've got to get some continuity in this whole pension business, in my opinion. And I think staying at the 95% limit of the governor is good. And if the units of government want to make a spiff for them, let them do it.
Mr. Chair, the last comment I'd like to just end with is that Mr. Martin has correctly pointed out in his memo that our pensions are based on the high 5 years.
Yep.
So they're supposed to the pension you receive is supposed to relate in some way, shape, or form to your immediate pre-retirement income. So I understand that if you're going to get paid $150,000 a year, but you're capped at 95% of the salary, the governor's salary on your pension side, you lose that, one of the objectives of the way the pension system's structured. And that's all I point out. But it's well covered in the staff memo.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarification, Ms. Vanek, if this legislation passes, though, and won't your fund be strengthened because there will be more money going into the fund as a whole?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, it depends upon what the individuals who receive those salaries do, because if they're getting higher salaries and we're projecting benefit payments on those higher salaries, that's an increase in what we pay out. If they don't stay in the system and withdraw, we will have collected higher employer contributions, and we gain from that. So it depends upon where they are in their career and what they actually choose to do.
But, and how soon they die.
Well, that too.
You know, and keep in mind, in terms of this equity issue, basically your city and county governments are saying, you let the schools out, how about us? I've observed that regardless of what somebody gets paid, they either complain about their level of pay or the amount of taxes they pay. I've noticed as tax chair that people with $25, $30 million in compensation complain that they're oppressed somehow by...
Not just athletes.
No, it's not actually athletes. The last athlete I remember commenting on this was, gee, I make a lot of money. I guess I should pay a lot of taxes. I don't hear that from... Just laying a little foundation for later in this room in about 2 weeks when someone has... over $50 or $60 million in deferred compensation that may never be taxable, and they complain about the tax level in the state. Just laying a little foundation.
Mr. Chair, are you going to bring in Sprewell?
I've actually never heard him complain about his taxes.
Feeding the family.
No, that's a different issue. You know, I don't want to get into family matters, but I, you know, when you're dealing with tax policy, I like to get into those matters.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
I was just an observation. I didn't mean to divert the conversation, but
Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment
on the deferred compensation of the taxes. Or
okay, no, it's on the Duluth Seaway Port Authority.
Okay, Port that's Authority. Was handed out Director. Here somewhere, I think.
Yep.
It was handed out, members.
Yes, handed.
Senator Larson.
Well, as I mentioned, the Port of Duluth is the largest port in the Great Lakes, and. The survey was just made. I'm on the Duluth Seaway Port Authority, and Representative Murphy has been on there too, I know. And so we have the largest port on the lakes, and he gets the lowest Port Authority pay. So I'd like to have him included in this.
On the Larson motion.
Could you make it the Larson Murphy motion?
Absolutely.
What's the director get paid? Any idea?
Well, it's 115, I think, or
115.
Something. Yeah. And the one, the Port Authority, I think at Toledo is 225. Smaller port.
Holy Toledo.
Holy Toledo. That's
Toledo.
Bad. That's
Klinger's
bad. All in favor of the Larson motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Ms. Nairn.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to clarify one matter. The bill that we introduced, Senate File 1206, provided that all elected officials of political subdivisions would be excluded from this law, and we also had an effective date that made it retroactive back to when the 1994 law was implemented. This is the identical language to what you did last year when you made the exclusion for MSRS and TRA employees. You made it clear that the law was retroactive back to the original effective date of this law so that they would never have been included. Otherwise, the county attorneys who have been receiving salaries will not get credit for that for the last number of years that their salary has been over this cap. So I would hope that if you decide to go with the 195 amendment that Mr. Carlson, I think, prepared, that added elected officials to the language that they were requesting for other local public employees, which we have no problem with, that you at least include the effective date that was in Senate File 1206 also.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I object to that. I object to make it retroactive.
Mr. Chair, last year when we addressed the issue, we recognized that, you know, some of the individuals who have already been paying in shouldn't be penalized now because they've already been paying in. They should be given credit for what they've paid in. That's why we had to make it retroactive. By the way, the other irony of all this is that for PERA, they were the ones that brought it to our attention, and when all was said and done, it was their employees that were not included in the final package.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Sir Larson.
Mr. Martin, have we ever made action like this retroactive?
Yes.
Last year, there were several exemptions, several hundred judges and some other individuals.
Several hundred judges?
Several hundred. 200 and I forget how many judges and a handful of other individuals, and it was made retroactive, Senator.
Mr. Chair, Senator Larson, in last year's bill, you did make it retroactive, and I think there were over almost 400 people who were affected by that retroactive date. All 300 judges in the state were affected. I think there were about 70-some employees from Minsky who were affected by that retroactivity. So when you did this change last year, you made it retroactive for everybody who had affected, and that's what we're respectfully requesting that you do now. I think the practical effect is it only affects 10 people, 12 people? 12 people.
Why don't we do this? Let's kind of shape this bill up in a way that we think roughly we'd like it, and then we'll set it aside, get some information for the commission on what these pensions potentially look like for some people, and then deal with it in total at that point. What I'd suggest is that we do make 195 retro and then adopt 195.
Mr. Chair?
And then Representative Tisa.
Just in 195, is that clear enough language to cover the waiver people?
I think the 195 will not touch the waiver people.
Mr. Chair, these are not the waiver people.
We have to talk about that separately. You want to do retro on here temporarily? Steve?
Sure.
So Representative Smith offers 195 with the addition of a retroactive clause.
Yeah.
Senator Larson.
Also, you know, we got the TRA report, and Mr. I think, you know, I have the letter of the TRA report from Gary Austin, and I don't remember if we all got a copy. I know Representative Smith got one, and Representative Tingles did, and Senator Higgins and Mr. Martin. But I would think that these letters should go to all the commission members, because this is the first time I've seen this.
I've not seen it.
So I think that, and also in regard to that, Mr. Chairman, I think the language that we put in the TRA report on salary audits, I think that should be included for all of the retirement plans, that the executive secretary or whoever is in charge should do an audit to be sure that, and I think Ms. Bannock does that, but I think that that might not be harmful language.
Okay, if they don't have it now, let's...
They should have it, yeah.
They should have it. That'll be incorporated on this 195 too. Keep in mind, we're just doing this. We'll get this all in front of us. We're just trying to get the sense of this right now. So on the Smith Amendment, with the retro and with the studies, if they're already not required.
Yeah. And Mr. Chairman, I think that's really important. Now, the municipal employees or the Rochester operation, I think we should have the audit there too. And I hope that, Mr. Vanek, you have responsibility for that? Okay.
Okay, on that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Okay, then we have the issue basically of, on page 5, those people. These are the, Representative Thiessen, what was your thinking on that? We would have to, and our options there are, we would have to specifically go in and mention these positions, or is that the way to get at it? You just... Well, individually mention them? Okay. Representative Thiessen.
And these are the people that have received the waiver?
Or
these
no.
These this are the is ones, the different mechanism.
These are the ones that would need a waiver or specific legislative authority.
I want to have Ms. Fanny make sure these are the right folk. These are the folk that were part of last year's exceed the maximum.
This was a list from last year. So this may not be totally updated, or what? Mr. Carlson, I see that Olmstead is here now. It wasn't here last year, I don't think. Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, the list that before you may not be totally comprehensive, but I don't believe there's an issue here. The positions with salaries exceeding the caps are all local government positions with the exception of the League of Minnesota Cities, which would be covered by the 195 amendment and the Minneapolis Teachers Retirement Fund. The rest of those are already accepted from the 356.11 a cap because they have been granted an exception under 43A.17. The positions down below, it is not currently an issue because they are not at the 43A.17 cap. So I don't believe you really need any further language. You have picked up the Minneapolis okay. Teachers Retirement Fund Association and the League of Minnesota Cities. The others are already covered under current law.
No, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Thiessen.
Mr. Chairman, just a question for Mr. Martin about resolutions. If they're local government officials, does the city council or the county board or somebody have to pass a resolution supporting this, or is this something we're bypassing local units of government?
Mr. Huben,
I would defer to Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Hubinger, what's the process? Does the LCC folks ask for, presumably that's who comes over and asks for it, not the employee.
Mr. Chair and members, part of the packet that a city or a county submits includes the resolution by the county board, by the city council supporting the increase.
Okay.
Is it automatic that is it two steps you could allow the salary to go but not the pension, or you doing both?
Mr. Chairman, members, if the salary is granted an exception, they're automatically granted an exception from the pension account.
Okay.
Just one other question, Mr. Do the local units of government know about the additional contribution that they make to the pension?
Mr. Chairman, members, yes, all the local governments are clearly cognizant of the fact that they have an obligation on the additional salary.
Okay.
Representative Thiessen, anything further?
No, I think that we can deal with this. It's a technical thing that I think we can deal with later. So.
Okay. Do we need to set this aside, or are people ready to go?
Well, I think we should take a look at it, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we'll temporarily set it aside as amended. And Senator Representative Murphy, you're ready to go?
Okay. There's a technical amendment, too.
Oh, we do need to do a technical amendment, 156, Bedsold moves, right?
Members, if I just explain for a moment, in going through and doing a survey of the other 50 states and trying to find their definition of salary and covered salary and having problems sometimes in their statutes finding it, it dawned on me that our statute isn't very clear either, that the definition of salary in MSRS law, for instance, doesn't cross-reference this 356.611 cap for either the cap we're talking about now or the federal limit cap which is part of that same section. So what this amendment does is adds the appropriate cross-references to all the definitions of salary on the public pension plan, saying subject to the limitations in section 356.611, okay, salary means.
I'll move that amendment.
Larson moves the 156. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All
aye.
Opposed. Motion adopted. Ms. Vanek, would you like, if we're going this route, would you like us to consider that issue of someone getting a bump at the end there and kind of smoothing that out a little with some kind of language?
Chair, I think we should consult with all the fund directors on that.
Okay, why don't, would the fund directors talk about that? Because that if we're proactive on that, we may avoid a controversy in the long haul about that. So why don't the fund directors talk about that, and when we come back on this, we'll deal with it. Okay, let's set it aside for now, and we'll take it up next time. Okay. Best just to go down the list here. Bed Sold Murphy, Minskew, IRAPS. Here we go. Mr. Martin or Mr. Burdick?
Members, should be item number two. It's marked with the number three because of the tab problem. What this bill would do is take a Minskew IRAP provision, which is the Higher Education Individual Retirement Account Plan, a defined benefit plan that provides coverage to many of the faculty and administrators in the Minskew system. It would revise an investment provision with the fund to allow the State Board of Investment Supplemental Fund to be not all offered to the Minskew members. Right now, the people who are in the IRAP plan have the ability to choose between, I believe it's 23 different investments, some of which are the State Board of Investment Supplemental Fund, and the actual investment offerings in there are noted on pages 1 and 2 of the memo: income share account, growth share account, common stock account, international share account. Those are all stock accounts, and then there are a few bond accounts and money market accounts. So what the bill does is simply gives Minskew the ability to not have to offer each of those supplemental fund accounts.
Okay.
Gary Janikowski, I'm System Director with Personnel with Minskew. And Mr. Chair, members, this particular recommendation emanates from a recommendation that came to us from our DCR Advisory Committee, which is composed of members.
DCR,
I'm sorry, Defined Contribution Retirement Plan. It's the same, it's IRAP. One of the IRAP plan is a part of that. And the intention here is to simplify our retirement plan so that participants aren't as confused about choices. For instance, rather than have 23 choices with many of these funds that overlap with regard to a fund objective and plan, we'd like to be able to narrow the choices so that rather than having three growth funds, we would just have one growth fund. Rather than having three stock funds, we'd have one stock fund. And our investment committee does evaluate these funds on a quarterly – or analyze them on a quarterly basis – and look at them against two preset standard benchmarks, and the funds have to meet or exceed those benchmarks or they're put on a watch list. And so we simply want to hold SBI funds to the same standard that the other funds are subject to. We'd like to be able to not have to offer a fund if we think we can find a better fund at a lower fee.
Okay. Mr. Stanton, do you want to testify? Okay with it? No controversy?
Should testify if he's going to testify.
Come for a time certain.
Chicken up there.
Oh, I know.
Mr. Chair, members of the Commission, Russ Stanton, interfaculty organization, represent the State University faculty who are covered by the funds. As Mr. Janikowski commented, this recommendation did grow out of an advisory committee that included all of the different employee groups of Minskew. I I have to say that I took it back to my membership, our Government Relations Committee, and their opinion was is they're very satisfied with the State Board of Investment Funds. They have very low fees. They have good rates of return, et cetera. Now my understanding is that they're not proposing to do away with the State Board of Investment Funds, but if they should happen to find a fund that's better than the State Board of Investment Fund, they could maybe do a swap out on that. I guess they're divided on it, but I don't see it as a major issue for us.
Okay, questions? Okay, Senator Representative Murphy, do you want to move it?
I will.
Anybody else want to testify? Representative Murphy moves House File 2101 or Senate File 1556 be incorporated. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed. Motion adopted. Let's go down to number 8. Senate File 1431, 1603. Mr. Martin.
This is really number 9.
Members, this deals with the Maplewood Volunteer Fire Plan and the Oakdale Volunteer Fire Plan. Part of Oakdale once was covered by the Maplewood Fire Department, and there are firefighters who eventually moved to Oakdale that have prior Maplewood firefighting service. And the intent here is to have the two volunteer fire plans enter into an agreement to transfer assets so that all of the pension coverage for these former Maplewood firefighters who are now Oakdale firefighters have their pension coverage all in one relief association. There are a couple of technical amendments, and there's one substantive amendment, and maybe after you've had a conversation, then we can cover what they are.
Kate?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Chuck Wigger from the Senate. Representative Slowick's here on behalf of our bills. Mr. Martin gave a good overview, and if you'd like to entertain the technical amendments that may be in order to put it in shape. Or if you'd like to wait, we could go to our witnesses.
Is there an issue?
It's more cautionary tales. It's
not. Okay, Senator.
I don't explain. They're too technical.
Right. Well, I was going to go. Let's do the 144 amendment first. Senator Bedsell moves it.
Members, 144 is a staff amendment. It's an attempt to streamline the process. The bill, as stated, would require the two relief associations and the two cities all as a foursome to negotiate the transfer agreement. This restructures it to have the two relief associations work out the deal and submit it to the two city councils.
I think that seems like a good idea. On the Bedsell amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted. 187, Murphy moves.
Members, 187 is suggested by the Oakdale contingent of this bill. There was an incorrect designation of the Oakdale Volunteer Fire Pension Fund, and this corrects that. It also removes the references to six firefighters because the number is less certain than six.
Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion's adopted.
Members, the substantive amendment adds a requirement to the potential agreement where the actual number of firefighters that are covered by the agreement would be named in that agreement or in some way identified. Since we're canceling folks' rights in one pension fund, moving them to another, just to give notice to all the individuals that they've got an impact in this, I think that somewhere in some document it ought to be named who these folks are or some way they're identified. And this would require that the agreement do that in some fashion.
Okay. Representative Smith moves that. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted. Okay, any other questions on this?
But Mr. Chair, it's not opposed. The respective cities of Oakdale and Maplewood have resolutions of support. We do have witnesses, Captain Mike Strowing from Oakdale Fire Department and Ed Dietz, the treasurer of the Maplewood Firefighters Association, here if you need testimony.
Do they feel the need to say something, or?
They feel the
need
to pass
it. I think we're
good
to go here. Senator Larson moves that House File 1608, Senate File 1431 be incorporated. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
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 As amended.
As amended.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted.
Thank you
very much. Appreciate it. Okay. Wardlow Bedsole, 1934 and 1741. Supplemental plans. Mr. Martin.
Members, this is an attempt to correct or to state in the statute the understanding having to do with broadened authorization for supplemental pension plans that was put into place a couple of years ago. If you look on the last page of the packet, the actual bill, the last part of the bill, we added a couple of years ago, the legislature added a couple of years ago, this is number four, it's tab four.
In the agenda for the tabs.
The legislature added as a authorized supplemental pension plan those plans that were funded out of employees' sick leave or vacation pay or severance pay. The sense was that this would be their pay at the time that they terminated employment. But apparently some vendors are misinterpreting or don't understand that this is a time-oriented set of dollars and are trying to do this annually as someone works through their career. Ed Minnesota brought a potential misunderstanding to our commission attention, and this bill was drafted to clarify that the accumulations are end-of-career dollars, not ongoing year-to-year-to-year dollars. Ed Minnesota may have some testimony they want to make on this topic also.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, Cheryl Fuhr representing Education Minnesota. This came to our attention over the last year that it was not really meeting the need because of the comments that Mr. Martin just made on the some of the vendors. It was not meeting the intent of the agreement that we had originally gone forward with MSBA, and we had clearly thought that it should just be determined for accumulated severance at the date of retirement or the termination of the active employee. So we thought by clarifying this and have it in law, it just really makes it very clear to vendors and anyone else looking at this that this was the true intent of the bill.
Any comment from the funds? Okay. Representative Wardlow moves 1934. Senate File 1741 be incorporated. No technical amendments necessary. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed.
Aye.
Motion adopted. Representative Thiessen, Senate House File 2031. I think we had this in the bill last year, if I'm not mistaken. Mr. Martin?
Members, Senate File 1763 and House File 2031, this would be tab 5 in your packets, has to do with University of Minnesota Police and whether they would be covered by PERA police and fire or not. The bill provides that those police officers at the University of Minnesota who are designated by the Board of Regents to be members of the faculty retirement plan at the university would be excluded from university or would be excluded from PERA police and fire coverage. We do have a couple of technical amendments, and we do have a substantive amendment.
Okay, Thiessen moves the 189. Mr. Martin?
I'm not sure if we necessarily want it. Can we hear from the university first on those?
These are post.
Ms. Watson?
Yes.
Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission. I'm Shelley Carthen Watson, and I serve as Associate General Counsel at the University of Minnesota. This particular piece of legislation is intended to address the presence of University of Minnesota police chiefs in the PARA plant. Currently, the university has two police chiefs on its Duluth and Twin Cities campuses, and they are members of our faculty retirement plan. They have ever been members of the PARA plan. And I'd like to give you just a little bit of background on that, if I may. We have five employee groups at the university: faculty, what we call professional administrative, civil service, who are our supervisory employees, bargaining unit employees, and our student employees. It's always been our policy to provide differing benefits for different employee groups, and our faculty and P&A employees, as we call them, are part of our faculty retirement plan. Our civil service employees and our bargaining unit employees are part of MSRS. We also have our own sworn police forces, and our police chiefs are part of the faculty retirement plan. Our captains and lieutenants are part of the civil service group, and they are part of PARA. And then our police officers themselves, which belong to a separate union, are part of PARA. Prior to 1978, both our chief of police and our captain positions were considered civil service, but we amended our faculty retirement plan, which has been in effect since 1963, and allowed high-earning civil service employees to join that particular plan. And that was to reflect the additional responsibilities that these particular individuals had throughout the university. Among the group of employees who were found to be eligible for the faculty retirement plan were our police chiefs. The captain of our police departments, who were not part of the faculty retirement plan, were not included and remained civil service and remained in the PARA plan. In 1980, the university created the new sort of P&A category, and our police chiefs were put into that particular category. The difference between that and civil service with respect to university benefits is that with our civil service employees, we need, of course, just cause, whereas those in the P&A categories are more managed, senior management. They have generally annual renewable appointments, and we consider them senior management and want to have the flexibility to hire and transfer and adjust their employment as may be necessary. About 3 years ago, we were notified by PARA that our police chiefs should be in the PARA plan. We have never included them in that plan. They'd always been in the faculty retirement plan. An issue came up with respect to our police chief on the Duluth campus. Since that date, we've been trying to work out some sort of resolution with PARA as to how to address this issue. We would prefer to keep our police chiefs in the faculty retirement plan because it is a more generous plan. It provides the equivalent of 13% of the police chief's salary, with the chief matching 2%, as opposed to the PARA contribution, which is less. It is our intent not to sort of circumvent any annuitant earnings or any sort of PARA legislation with this amendment. It is intended to be limited only to University of Minnesota police chiefs. Those are the only police officers eligible for the faculty retirement plan. And we only have two chiefs, and we don't anticipate adding any more to the university.
Which amendment are we on, if any at all?
We're in the bill.
All right.
I'm certainly happy to answer any questions you may have.
Anyone have questions? President Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I have one, but I think I want to hold it until after Ms. Vanek talks, if she's going to talk.
Representative Thiessen, do you have a question?
Not right now.
All right. If there are no questions, thank you. Ms. Watson.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, Mary Vanek, PARA Executive Director. I think Ms. Watson has fairly represented the issue this, we weren't even aware that the university wasn't reporting their police chiefs to our police and fire fund until a Duluth officer was recruited to serve in the position as police chief at the campus in Duluth. That individual retired, took the position, and we started applying our retirement offset for people who are retired, drawing an annuity, and go into a job that's covered by us. That is when the university raised with us, we have never believed our police chiefs were intended to be covered by para PNF. We looked at our law and said that it clearly states that a licensed officer in charge of a designated police department is to be covered by para, and so we encouraged the university to seek legislation to correct it. The current chief on the Twin Cities campus has been employed since about a year. We had him sign off on a letter stating that we would waive contributions until the university could get this issue resolved through the legislature. And if they're unsuccessful, then we are going to compel contributions.
Questions of Ms. Vanek. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Ms. Vanek, you support this legislation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we do.
Okay. And so then, just for clarification, and Ms. Watson, just for clarification, be retired from and retirement benefit from para and be contributing to the university pension fund as you describe. So they could be collecting their para at the same time that they were working for the university?
That, in fact,
would be the case. We believe that that is a limited circumstance. We had one police chief from the Duluth campus where that situation arose, which led to this legislation. For the most part, our police chiefs have come from out of state, or they have not been para members. And the current university, Twin Cities police chief, is not a para member.
Up north, it's more likely that that's going to happen. Ms. Watson, then this would take care of all those issues that came up 3 years ago.
Yes, belatedly. Yes.
Good, Mr. Chair. I think we should move it. But you need an amendment.
Hey, Representative Thiessen.
So I think we should now move the 189, the technical amendment.
Thiessen moves 189. Discussion of that?
Members, if I can tell you what 189 is. The bill provides for an exclusion from PERA coverage, and when I went back to look at PERA statutes, trying to find the inclusion language that I worked on in 1978, it's been repealed back in 89 for some reason, and I'm not sure exactly why. So it seemed to me odd to have an exclusion when you didn't have a clear or clean inclusion. So what the 189 amendment does is clearly indicates that the university is a governmental subdivision, which is the way that covered employers in PERA law are laid out, and also puts into a law that unless the bill language excluding the person applies, anyone who is a peace officer at the university is in PERA police and fire. So it essentially puts us back where it should have been in 1978 prior to the 89 repeal of another section.
Okay, on the Thiessen, anybody want to testify? On the Thiessen motion, Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify. There is another section of Law 353-663 that refers to the original law that merged the two that's still in para, but it is part of a repealer in one of the bills proposed by Senator Betzold, so we agree with the staff's position that this would clearly direct what's going on.
Okay. On the Thiessen motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted.
And just to could staff explain the 190? Just
Mr. Martin?
Members, when a peace officer is covered by PERA police and fire, in essentially all circumstances, the employer gets police state aid. It wasn't clear to me factually what the university was trying to do here and whether, and I'm not sure who is being certified by the university currently as a peace officer for getting state aid. But a police officer who's covered by the faculty plan doesn't meet the requirements of Chapter 69 should not be included in police state aid, and this merely clarifies that, so that revenue, who doesn't always necessarily pay attention to the particulars of pension statutes, doesn't inadvertently give the university police state aid for someone who isn't in a public safety pension plan.
Go ahead.
I apologize because I'm not familiar with the aid process. It's my understanding that we currently report all post-certified officers, but we certainly understand that if these individuals, if the police chiefs are removed from the from para and are placed in the faculty retirement plan, that the university may not be eligible for that aid.
Okay. Representative Murphy. Okay.
But, Mr. Chair, we're still requiring that they be post-certified.
Yes.
Police chiefs have to be post-certified.
Yes, that is a requirement for all of our positions, including the chief position.
Members, that would be a university requirement, not a state pension law requirement.
Then I'll move the 190.
They're not going to change that date. Thiessen moves the 190. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Aye. Motion adopted.
And, Mr. Chair, I don't think we want to move the 191.
Okay. Good to go?
Members, if I could raise one other question. The testimony, if you look at the bill, which is the final page, page 1, line 11, talks about a police officer in a very generic way. The intent, as I understand it, is the two police chiefs. And if it is only the two police chiefs, perhaps the language ought to reflect a police chief rather than a police officer.
We included originally when we were discussing the language, we included the broader language because sometimes the police chiefs hold dual roles. For example, they may serve, the current Twin Cities chief serves as vice president, associate vice president for campus health and safety and is in charge of, is not only chief of police, but is in charge of emergency management. We thought that it would perhaps be cleaner to eliminate those police officers who were members of the faculty retirement plan, irrespective of their particular title.
I think that we picked that up, Mr. Chair, by doing what they did. I think it's
clear. Broader language, because the requirement is that they're required to be in the faculty retirement plan, and the only ones they're requiring to be in the faculty plan are the persons who are doing that type of duty.
But it may be someday that they change the title.
Right. Okay. So Thiessen moves House File 2031, Senate File 1763 as amended. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All
aye.
Opposed. Motion adopted. Is Rukavina back? Representative Rukavina? About what?
If I could do that one.
259. Mr. Martin?
Members, this would be tab 7 in your packets.
You know, let's get some of these other little ones out of here first. This looks like it's going to take a little time.
State auditor's sitting here.
It's okay.
Actually, this is a pretty easy one.
Is it? Okay.
Yes.
It looks complex.
No,
all right. Mr. Martin?
No, it's easy.
Easy?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
The print got very small all of a sudden here.
No, but yeah.
Mr. Martin?
Members, what you have here is the recommendations of a working group that was put together by the state auditor to look at volunteer fire issues. That group met during the course of the fall and made a number of changes. Are recommending a number of changes. The length of the summary has to do with the number of changes and the fact that we highlight for you changes that do have policy implications, and they made a number of changes, so you have a number covered by the summary. This is not of a controversial nature, however, and we have members of the task force here who may want to run through and give you the high points. The volunteer fire law was recodified in 1979. It was piecemeal or non-existent prior to 1979. This is the first fairly thorough review of the volunteer fire laws that has occurred since 1979, okay. Which in part is why there are a lot of potential changes here.
Why don't we have a general review, Auditor? Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I go over the specific changes.
We can read the specific changes. Yeah. Why don't you just give us general overview of
I will. Thank
of
you,
the
Senator.
Process and why you set it in motion and so forth.
Thank you, Senator. When we took a look about a year ago at the laws, and there's some things that are sort of antiquated or maybe need to be changed, and we put together a working group, and it had approximately 15 of us maybe met many, many times, and not always friendly, not always people that agree with each other on all the issues. There were representatives of the League, of the Fire Reliefs. Ed Dietz was from Maplewood, Dave Ganfield, Niall Zickman are here also. Big plans and the small plans. And what we agreed to when we sat down is that we were going to create a bill that only included the things that we all unanimously agreed to. And that's what is before you. There are other issues that we put off, and we've all committed to working next or this coming fall on some of those issues to see if we can solve some of those. So what's in front of you are things that were unanimous with the entire committee. I also want to thank yourself and your staff. Ed and Larry were very helpful. They did sit in on our meetings and guided us, gave us history and legislative intent back from 79 and so on. And so what you see is the summation of sort of a lot of work and unanimous consent amongst all the parties involved.
Okay, very good.
Else?
Somebody else? My name is Ed Dietz from Maplewood. I would like to thank everybody for having an opportunity to come here. And we obviously had a good working relationship in that group, and we're all in consensus of it. Thank you for your understanding.
Mr. Zickman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Niall Zickman representing Minnesota Fire Chiefs in Spring Lake Park, Blaine Moundsview. I was invited to the task force as the chief of a monthly plan and as the representative from Minnesota Fire Chiefs. I'd like to express my gratitude, appreciation to the auditor. There's a number of issues we were able to resolve. I think a dozen came through on this bill, and we've got another half dozen unresolved, and I'm sure by next fall we'll have added to that list. I would just comment on the amendments that were outlined by commission staff, the LCPR, the 25 and 26, in a meeting with the folks in the back room and talk with the auditor staff. We feel those amendments would be appropriate in support of those. The other amendments we wouldn't comment on until commission staff felt the need to raise some of those issues. There are some that we talked about we could actually bring up again this fall and continue discussing in that manner. So there'd be another
25
option.
And 26 are ones that by consensus?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Bedsold moves. I'm on the potential amendments here on the second page.
Right.
Bedsold moves 025. Mr. Martin.
Members, 025 has to do with a grandparenting of a benefit level provision that once was in the volunteer fire law in 1979, was dropped sometime during the late 1980s, and apparently would be helpful if it was reincorporated into the volunteer fire law. It basically says that your service pension maximum that you had in the prior year is your baseline service pension maximum for the future, and that you can go up, but you can't go down. And the problem is sometimes people are required to go down, and that's caused benefit problems.
Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion adopted. Smith moves 26. Mr. Martin.
Members, 026 has to do with the military leave provisions. When the commission looked at the requirement of the federal law on military leaves, we did not look at how it would apply to volunteer fire. This group did look at volunteer fire and proposed a military leave provision for all the defined benefit volunteer fire plans. There are 50 defined contribution plans which were not covered by the provision that the working group worked on. 026 is the same concept language for defined contribution plans.
On the Smith motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion adopted. Members of the commission have any interest in any of the other amendments?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bedsall.
I see a number of them put limitations on where they can be investing. I'm just kind of curious as to, you know, what the issues are that have caused some concerns.
Mr. Martin.
Members, what you have here are the amendments that were forwarded to the working group. We put together for the working group essentially the same sort of policy issue paper on the proposals as they were working through them, and we suggested alternatives or limitations or other ways to look at the problem, and that's what you have here. I think if we were to raise a particular issue, it really has to do with legislative history and the regulation of the use of non-investment-grade bonds, otherwise known as junk bonds. The legislature created a separate investment authority law for local and volunteer fire pension plans back about a decade and a half ago, specifically when the state board got into junk bonds and the legislature was unhappy or didn't want other pension plans to get into junk bonds. The volunteer, because junk bonds are not specifically exempt, are not specifically banned in 356, they're just not authorized. Some volunteer fire plans are apparently utilizing junk bonds, and a lot of the amendments that you see here relate to junk bonds or how the 356A chapter legal list of authorized investments relates to the State Board of Investment. But I think the real key is, if we had to identify one, the use or permissible use or non-permissible use of junk bonds by volunteer fire plans.
Was there discussion of this? It looks like 21, 22, 23, and 24 kind of deal with that general area.
My name is David Ganfield. I'm secretary of the Minnesota State Fire Department Association. I'm also the administrator for Apple Valley Fire Relief with the combination monthly lump sum plan. I, too, acknowledge that this was a great working group. It's the first time we've ever seen this type of system work out with the auditor's office and the assistance of the Larry Martin and Ned Burke with the Pension Commission. I think it's a system that worked very well, and some of these amendments that you're discussing now weren't brought up during that time. We do plan on meeting again in the fall, and I think it would be something that let the system work. The Pension Commission working group or the auditor's working group has had the opportunity to go through these issues, and that would be an appropriate forum, in my opinion, as far as how we'd handle that.
Mr. Zickman?
Mr. Chairman, I just comment on the issue. There's a couple problems, or maybe I should just highlight. We don't believe, I do a fair amount of teaching all over the state, there's not a large number of reliefs in junk bonds. The problem is we don't really know who is into junk bonds, and to get that information would be problematic, would take some time. And if you did adopt, for example, 21, there would have to be an effective date of 2008, really, before all those reports came in, because it's a year delay in getting them to the auditor, and the auditor has to have time to get back to the relief and inform them along what you could have happened then is a number of reliefs. If you just put this implementation date that then wouldn't get certified, you'd have a number of legislators getting contacted then because they didn't get their fire state aid. And it almost becomes counterproductive. It tied in with the only penalty reliefs have right now is total withholding of state aid. And we did talk about trying to propose in the future here a stepped penalty. But if you have a relief that's in junk bonds and they lose a couple $1,000s because of that investment, but then you withhold $20,000 in state aid, it seems like you're working against the whole process. So that's part of the discussion we feel we need to have, and we could have that better in the working group and come forward and do some of the self-policing. It wouldn't be, you know, there's not a wholehearted let's get into junk bonds. We need to get into junk bonds. It's more of that logistical problem of getting there, getting the education out, and how we oversee that without causing more punitive consequences through withholding that state aid.
Ms. Otter, I was going to ask Otter.
Yep. Thank you, Senator. we've been working separately with Karen from Minneapolis Teachers on a separate bill, which we hope to get before you in your crunch time frame. And we do have some draft language that does deal with this issue. It does have a three-year, allows a three-year window for those that are in, because it's very difficult to sell, you know, immediately. It also deals with an index fund issue for those of you that have buy individual stocks, your QQQs and so on. Those are not essentially covered. And so it deals with those two issues. It is a separate bill that we do hope to be able to get before you, but it does include the three-year phase-in also. We do have language drafted, but it's not in the correct format to potentially add as an amendment. I don't know.
Are you I'm sorry, I didn't hear everything you said. Are you comfortable? Do you see any merging? Do you see any reason to make decisions on some of these amendments in this investing area now, or do you agree that just keep working this fall and people will come back next year and we're not in any danger of anything bad happening before then? Are you comfortable with that process? Don't do amendments like this now and just kind of wait for continued work by your group?
Senator, I wish if the ideal situation is if I could continue to work with the large funds and specifically Karen Kilberg, and also work, talk to the group, I think we would all be in agreement, but I hate to do things this quickly. So we'll, perhaps we could have something by next week even.
Okay, if perhaps, you do. If you
as
do,
a separate we'll, bill.
Okay, if you do, we'll take it up. If
okay.
not, we'll just assume that your working group will look at these
yes.
types of amendments in the fall and let us know mm-hmm. whether some of this should be done.
Okay.
Okay, and thank you for your good work on this.
Thank
Appreciate you,
you
bringing folks together and
Thanks.
Moving things forward.
Thank
Anybody
you.
Else want to testify in this? Were you? Okay. You're not sitting there going, no, you better do something on those? Okay. All right, so we have Bedsold moves 259, Senate file, House file 1706, as amended, be incorporated. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted.
Thank you, members.
Representative Ruk, thank you very, very
thank
much,
you.
All of you. Representative Rukavina, why don't we take up your two bills?
Sure. No, but I'll try. So be it. Sir, we will try. All right, where are we
at? Mr. Chair, would you mind, since I have the city administrator from Hoyt Lakes here, would you mind if we jumped to House File 240 so he could get back on the road?
I found it. Representative Rukavina, that's fine. Go ahead and present your testifier.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, what we're trying to do here is the cities of Hoyt Lakes, Aurora, and I have Mr. Rick Bradford, the city administrator from Hoyt Lakes, but the city of Hoyt Lakes, Aurora, town of White, and the city of Bowabic had inquired about special legislation if they consolidated their volunteer fire departments to pay the highest rate, which is in law right now after consolidation from that point forward, but to pay what the other different fire departments had prior to that consolidation, and then it would be prorated, I believe, Mr. Martin, if the bill was drafted the way I wanted, which I think it was, that the obligation, let's say if they had 20 years with the town of White Volunteer Fire Department and then 10 with the new one, they would be paid at that rate for the 20 years, and the new rate, the highest rate of the four consolidated ones for the last 10. And I do have letters of support from all four units of government. If staff would like that, because I don't know if I ever forwarded it to the Pension Commission, to Mr. Martin. And
you can submit those. We'll pick those up now.
Okay. And I believe that all of the different departments except the Bowabic one has as also shown their support. So just about everybody's on board.
Pardon? Do we have amendments here that we need to address?
Members, in your packet, you do have two amendments. One is technical. At least it's technical, assuming that it's Bowabic City that is interested in the there is a Bowabic Township volunteer fire plan, and that's what first caught my eye. And so there's a little cleanup of the language.
Mr. Chair, the Buwabic Township Volunteer Fire Department is independent and not involved in this consolidation and
members,
never has to be.
Dash 153 specifies that it's the Buwabic City Volunteer Fire Plan and also attempts to clean up the style a bit of the language in the bill. Would not be a substantive change.
Representative Rogovini, I understand that's all right with you.
Yes, that's
I'll let the record reflect, first of all, that Representative Osment moves House File 240, Senate File 623. And then on that amendment, 153, their discussion or questions?
Oh, Mr. Chair, we're lacking a Senate quorum at the moment.
I'm sorry?
We're lacking a Senate quorum at the moment.
Are you suggesting that, or are you just
I'm just pointing it out that it's just me. We can still discuss it, but I'll be happy to move it once I get some of my colleagues back. But
on that amendment, 153, Senator Betzold. All right, we'll lay that aside. Is there another amendment?
Members, there is one additional amendment. The problem that these four volunteer fire plans have is they wanted to do something different than the general law provides. What the Dash 154 amendment does is adds this as an alternative to the general law. So it says you can do it the way it currently is provided for in general law, which is you make retroactive to the start of everyone's service in a consolidating set of volunteer fire plans the highest benefit level of any one of the consolidating volunteer fire plans. What these folks want to do is do what they used to do before the date of consolidation, continue that lower level of benefits potentially, and then post-consolidation do the highest level of benefits. And this allows, in general law, this amendment would place the Abu Wabik Aurora Palo alternative as an alternative in general law. Our current general law is really derived from two prior consolidations, the Golden Valley or the Crystal New Hope and the Young American Norwood. And both of those wanted to do it the way the current general law provides. And that's why the general law provides it. This is the first group that's wanting to do something different rather than potentially have special laws in the future doing the same thing. If this makes sense, we could encapsulate it in general law. So it's a substantive amendment but does not do any damage to Representative Rogovina's bill, just simply makes it more generally applicable.
Representative Rogovina, you've heard that.
Mr. Chair, I saw the amendment, and frankly, I don't have a problem with that because, you know, with pressures being put on local units of government, I'm sure that there may be more attempts at doing this, so I don't have a problem at all. The reason we had to draft this special legislation is because of what was in statute on consolidation. So if the commission feels that way, that's fine with me.
On that amendment, do we have a motion?
I'll move it.
Representative Murphy, then on the, let's see, 154. We have 153 on the table. Let's go back to that one. Betzold moves 153 amendment discussion. All right, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. That prevails. Then on the 153, Representative Murphy, any questions or discussion on that? 154. Excuse me. On that motion, hearing no discussion, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. That prevails. The amendment is adopted. Any further amendments?
We just want to temporarily, we're going up to Commerce to get the senators.
Okay. Lay it over.
Just temporarily put it aside, I guess.
Move on to the next one.
Book of Bean's got another bill.
Let's just temporarily lay that aside. You have another bill, Representative Rogovina. Do you want to go over that? All right.
Mr. Chair,
that'd be House File 94, am I correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senate File 157.
Mr. Chair, this is the bill that's been in front of this committee many times before, and it is just a $100 a month bump for the five now. We are down to five. I promised Senator Pogemiller years ago that this number would be reduced over the years, and for a few years it was there were about nine survivors. There's only five left now. There are four surviving spouses, and Mr. Elio Varani, who's a good friend of mine, who's 97 years old and still mows his lawn, and with a push mower, too, I think. So They've been doing this, the City of Eveleth, for years. I know Mr. Martin has some suggestions, so we don't have to keep doing this every other year, that we would just put it in statute, and I don't know if Mr. Martin wants to talk about that. That would be fine with me. As you can see by the information, Mr. Chair, besides Mr. Varani, who is 97, the surviving spouses are 95, two of them are 88, and one's 86. So I don't know how much longer we'd have to do this, but if there's a better way to do it, as Mr. Martin suggests, I'd be more than happy to accept someone offering that amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill.
Okay. For the record, Representative Murphy moves the bill. Mr. Burek, would you comment?
Mr. Chairman, there are a few amendments for consideration there. They're described on page 4. I believe the amendment that Representative Rukovina was specifically referring to would be the 035 amendment. And what that would do is it would allow the city to provide an increase to these individuals not to exceed $100 per month every other year. That is equivalent to what has been occurring for the last decade or so with this fund, except that every other year the trust fund would come before the commission and legislature and ask for the authority. So this would get the legislature out of the loop there and would simply allow the city to provide $100 increase every other year if they so desired.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of Amendment 35.
Discussion on the amendment. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. That passes. Do we have another amendment?
Mr. Chair, I still would like to get a report on the people each year because I feel kind of like I know them, because we've heard about them for so long. So,
well, Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, I called Joe Begich up last night about something else, and he said that just the other day he saw two of these ladies are sisters, and they were walking down the street together talking, he said. So then maybe it was the 88 and the 86-year-old. I don't know which.
Well, Representative Ravina, you've submitted some letters already. Can you get them to write a letter to Representative Murphy? She could share it with us.
Chair, I'll get them to write a Valentine to
thank you. Mr. Beery.
Mr. Chairman, there are no technical amendments, and the other three amendments were alternatives to the one that has already been adopted. So Commissioner presumably doesn't want to consider.
So no further amendments. I think we may lay this bill aside till we have sufficient voting strength, but it looks like there doesn't seem to be any opposition. If you want to wait, it'd be fine.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Larson.
I'll move the bill pending the return of Senator Pocomelli.
We've got a mover of the bill right now, Representative Murphy.
Okay.
We're in a little state of flux here with faces on our commission. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, we have the Commerce Committee meeting in the Senate, and three of our members, Senator Pocomelli, Michelle, and myself are there, and they stayed to vote. I made my speech and left.
Senator Larson, I could pretend I'm one of the senators for a
while
if you want.
You're welcome.
Don't put me in length, says Chair Senator. I might change the bonding bill. Thank you, members.
Representative Rogovina, thank you.
Members, in the minute that we have, hopefully until we get a Senate quorum, in the very bottom of your packets, you should have a document that we're not going to act on today, but I did want to draw your attention to it. It's LCPR 05-201. Our practice and what we're doing again this year is, as you add things to the omnibus pension bill or bills, we give you a running version of what we've done. So this reflects the Wednesday meeting materials that were folded into a single bill. Yes, members. And normally we would have a section by section summary on it, but time did not permit, given the shortness of the turnaround to get this meeting out. So in the future you will get a similar document, and there will also be a cover memo telling you what is in it.
It's also
And for individuals in the audience who are interested, it's also on the web as the working version of the omnibus pension bill.
And as an aside, the record should reflect that the previous bill that Representative Rukavina had, the 240, that Osmond would be the offer of that bill. What do you suggest we do at this point? Proceed to another bill for presentation? Which one?
The next one, I think, is the number 9. Yes.
10. All right, then let's move for presentation number 10 on the list. Senate file 1927, Betzold. House file 1799, Wardlow.
Number 9 on the agenda.
It's number 10 on the agenda that you were sent out on the pre-distribution, and it's number 9 on the current agenda.
And number 10 on the tab.
Okay. And now you have three Senate members.
Okay, form.
Well, let's revert back to
Senate File 623 is the first one.
Which item? Okay, item 7. Senate File 623, yes. Thomasoni, House File 240.
It's tab 8, yeah.
And that's, we've heard that bill, and that's on, it's been, we've done the amendments. Who's the, who's moved the bill?
Osmond.
Oh, that Representative Osmond moves the bill. Any discussion on that one? All those, if not, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. That passes for inclusion. What else did we have on this?
Take some clarification on which amendments were added to that.
Members,
we're back on the motion. We just need some clarification on which amendments were added.
153,
154.
Members, the bill we're dealing with is on tab 8 in your packets. It's Senate File 623, House File 240. It's the Aurora, Bowabic, Hoyt Lakes, Palo possible consolidation bill. And the technical amendment and the substantive amendment were both adopted. The technical amendment cleans up the language. The substantive amendment adds the special law approach as a general law approach also.
So your records have just for purposes, Smith moves 153, 154. Discussion, all in favor say aye.
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 All opposed, motion adopted. Senate File 623, House File 240 as amended be incorporated. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All
aye.
Opposed, motion adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Number 5.
I renew my motion to adopt Senate File 157, House File 94, as amended with Amendment 35.
Murphy moves Amendment 35 first. I was in and out, and I noticed, is that the preferred out of these various alternatives, how to do it rather than cost of living and stuff? Okay. So Murphy moves the old 35. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All
aye.
Opposed. Motion adopted. Murphy moves Senate File 157, House File 94 as amended. All in favor say aye.
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 All
aye.
Opposed. Motion adopted. Does anybody want to reconsider now that Senator Thomasoni has shown up?
Move.
So moved.
So moved.
Rukavina got it done, and now there could be problems.
Hey, congratulations.
Okay. Wardlow, 1799, Betzold, 1927. Mr. Burke.
It's a perennial task force.
Members, what these bills would do is create a task force, a volunteer firefighter relief association task force, with also with some representatives of the task force from various insurance groups and also the state auditor. The bill is a scaled-down version of some bills that were introduced a few years back. Bills were introduced on this topic in 2002, 2003, 2004. The bills currently before you are based on the 2003, 2004 versions of the bill, which are a scaled-down version of the 2002 version. In particular, what happened, the key difference is a considerable difference in the appropriation that is being proposed. The earlier bill is at a $300,000 appropriation. That's currently down to $40,000. And there also are some requirements that were in the early bills that don't appear here, particularly a requirement that the task force hold public meetings. sample the views of the volunteer firefighter community on this particular issue. The bill raises several issues which the commission may wish to address through the various amendments, which are all substantive in nature and are summarized either on the executive summary page or with a little bit more detail on page 3 of the memo. With those comments, I'll turn it back to the commission.
Okay, Senator Bedsold.
This is the perennial volunteer firefighter task force omnibus.
Why does it never become law?
Money.
It's the $40,000 appropriation. Is that the issue?
It's the appropriation, Mr. Chair, and also there's not been a unanimity among the ranks as to whether this should be done or not.
Barth killed it last year.
Mr. Chairman, Niles Zickman, to add a little bit to the discussion, the Senate did pass the bill last year. It was up in the House, literally the waning hours of the session.
Did we pay for it? Or
you paid for it. The okay. House had it in the bill also, and it was one of those end-of-session highlights that we just soon forget. But it really was defeated more on a philosophical difference. Representative Hackbarth just has a strong belief that this is a precursor to a mandated statewide plan. And there's really nothing further from the truth. Representative Wardlow had contacted myself and other members of the Volunteer Fire Service, Mr. Ganfield here, and had an interest in this. We were actually going to maybe take a year off, but because of his interest, there's still a strong, strong need. I'd like to describe it now. We're into the ultra-marathon on this, but I believe we could be successful again in getting the appropriation. We have worked with Representative Hackbarth and Representative Davids. We've informed Representative Wardlow that's where the opposition will come from. We believe we've made some inroads with Representative Davids, and we think we can maybe convince Representative Hackbarth even to let this thing go through and let the study go through there. I'm not saying that's for sure, but we're willing to give that another shot. We'd appreciate the commission support because the need is there.
So, Representative Wardlow, Senator Bedsold, do any of the amendments, do you want it the way it is, or do any of the amendments help get you where you're trying to get?
Perhaps we should.
Yeah.
Mr. Zickman?
Mr. Chairman, members, the First Amendment, 177, seems to make sense.
Okay. Representative Wardlow moves the 177. This gets to the issue of whether you're mandating a single sale. You're kind of just looking at it maybe. Okay. So on the 177, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Any other ones that help move this forward?
Mr. Chairman, representatives, it'd be a modification on 170 or maybe one of its own. I don't know if there's any value in reducing the numbers. The fire service has always been able to work with small numbers, big numbers. But Representative Hackbarth did indicate a problem that it wasn't clear that these would be volunteers serving on the task force. And so if we were to add a verbal amendment that directs the members from the fire associations to be members of a volunteer relief or volunteer firefighters, I can tell you that they wouldn't be other members because they're coming from those groups. But if it would help get the bill passed to clarify in the law, he had indicated that into a letter to a fire department that had corresponded with him, that it wasn't clear that these were volunteer firefighters directing the task force. Maybe we could add that in.
So on line 13, we could put the task force members would be volunteers as follows. Mr.
Members, Martin? I'm not sure putting it on line 13 is the best because that the membership is both volunteer fire and city officials.
Where might you put that?
So I think you would, on lines 14, 16, 18, and 20, you would, I'm sorry, not 20, 14, 16, and 18, after the word members, you would put in who are volunteer firefighters and are.
Okay, Representative Wardlow moves on line 14, 16, 18, comma, who are volunteer members, comma.
Or volunteer firefighters.
Or volunteer firefighters,
and
comma.
Are.
Okay. Discussion on the Wardlow Amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All
aye.
Opposed. Motion adopted. Mr. Tess. school regional appropriation. That'll get decided at a later date. Specifies if the proportional range could be used. Do you need, does any, nothing helps? Okay. Representative Wardlaw, is this about as best as we're going to get it now?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Representative Wardlaw moves that House File 1799, Senate File 1927, as amended, be incorporated. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All
aye.
Opposed, motion adopted.
Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Hogemeller, 1682.
I sure was.
I think this was in our bill last year also. Parts of it might have been. Should we take some explanation of what the... Does someone want to testify? And Ms. Vanek, is the language where you need it to be, or we're going to need some more work on this? Okay. Please, join us first. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Todd Pufall. I'm the business manager for City Employees Local 363. I'll be testifying on behalf of this bill amongst the interested parties. First, I guess I think it's necessary to kind of reiterate a little bit about the intent or the reason behind the changes that we're seeking. We were here back in 2001. At that time, this body did approve our ability to participate in our international pension and other local pensions in order as an exemption, as a supplemental pension. Our goal at the time, or our intent at the time, was to try to provide additional resources or diversify retirement options for our members in order to make up the difference that they were losing when moving from, in our case, one pension plan level to another. As you probably are, most of you are aware that in 1978, the MRF pension fund was closed, and after that, all of my members participate in PARA. Currently, in past in MRF, due to the very physically demanding work that our members do, we represent arborists, tree trimmers, solid waste and recycling workers, construction and maintenance laborers, do very physically demanding work. Under MRF, they were able to retire at 30 years or 29 years in one day at any year of age with approximately 70% of their pre-retirement income. A member in PARA who was hired after 1989 who retires now with, let's say they started at age 22 and are at age 55 and have worked 33 years, would be retiring with a percentage of their income of 28.44%. Clearly, they're not going to be able to retire solely on PARA at 28.44% of their income. My average labor currently makes about $40,000. That would leave them with about $907 a month to retire on. And we do not have employee-subsidized health care, and the current family plan for health care is about $700 a month, leaving that individual with, you know, no option to retire at an age at which before they become a liability to the employer attempting to do the strenuous work that they're employed to do. We researched and worked with Mary and her staff to see if there was some way we could try to proactively address this impending issue that will both negatively impact our members and the employers that employ them, and see if there was some way we could explore getting into some of the like public safety funds with their formulas that would have an earlier out with a higher contribution rate, and weren't able to come up with a way to do that in time for this group. So we basically looked at the options we had within our international union and our local union pensions as a vehicle in order to provide them with some supplemental income to not only help them retire, you know, with the burden of the health care insurance, but also with the ability to have an income that a person could choose to retire rather than having to continue to work at a very strenuous employment and become a liability to the employer with workers' compensation, disability pensions, et cetera. So that was the rationale that this body originally listened to and agreed to allow our participation. At the time, there was a historical cap of $2,000 in contributions that was in the bill. Currently, I see there is one that has moved to 27, and there is another one that is still at 2,000. At the time, you know, we didn't want to ask for additional consideration, so, you know, we got the opportunity to participate, and in the interim since 2001, we have, in fact, moved our contribution rate up to 72 cents, and some of the other bargaining units have jumped in initially at the 96 cents, which is the maximum allowed under the current cap under the law.
that amount is not enough to supplement or get the benefit out of these international and local union plans in order to situate an individual to be able to afford prior to becoming a liability to the employer, and also be able to have choose the survivor options as well as the health care costs. So the bottom line is that is the rationale behind our desire to not have to come back here again before you and raise the cap to $5,000. In the other instances where there's a $2,700 cap and a $2,000 cap, you will note that that is an employer match to an equivalent amount of an employer contribution. So in fact, in the law, there already is the possibility for an individual to contribute a total of $4,000 in the $2,000 cap, and of course $5,400 in the $2,700 cap. So we're looking to get your consideration to raise that cap to $5,000 in order to not have to come before you again and have the ability to redirect our members' own negotiated wages to this investment to situate them such that they can retire before they become a liability to the employer. The other piece of the bill is a clarification of that these contributions do, in fact, constitute salary for para purposes. As I mentioned earlier, these are contributions that are made in lieu of wages. They are redirected wages. We negotiate a particular increase from the employer, after which with the membership decides how much of that increase they would like to put towards securing a better retirement so they can afford to retire. In our case, we have thrown nickels and dimes at it over the course of the years, and we've got it up to 72 cents. In the 49ers and the plumbers' case, they jumped right in with 96 cents, and they're currently at the level permitted under the law. So at the time when we negotiated this, it was the employer's belief or that it was salary for para purposes. They basically were looking at the state law, at least at the Park Board's case, with their counsel, Jim Michaels of Rice, Michaels, and Walters, looked at it with the comma after supplemental employee contributions and interpreted that, in fact, that these contributions would be considered salary for para purposes. The 49ers had negotiated these kinds of contributions for their members in a number of towns and municipalities across the state, and those towns and municipalities, as I understand it, were contributing to counting this as salary for para purposes. In the interim, we had some clarification and discussion with PARA, and it was decided that the law was unclear and that I think we were both here agreeing that there needs to be some clarification to the law, and we currently support the amendment that Mary is proposing to offer to you after I get done. The other piece that we have kind of anticipated that may be controversial and was added in order to address that issue I just referenced, whereby some of the municipalities and townships that Local 49 had negotiated had been contributing to PARA, the retroactive piece at the end of the bill. If that should be considered controversial, the 49ers are willing to drop that piece and go with the joint desire to clarify the definition of salary and your consideration over raising the cap. Thank you.
Ms. Bannock.
PERA took a very conservative approach to this issue. We understand that the contribution to the union pension fund is required to be an employer contribution. It's not supposed to be a reduction of members' pay and an employee contribution. What we found is that through negotiations, there were decisions made that an X percentage raise would be granted, but so much of that raise would then be deducted from the individual's pay as a contribution to the union pension fund. And we said, well, how can it be an employee reduction and an employer contribution at the same time? So we took a very conservative approach and said, we deem this to be an employer contribution. It may be that the employer is saying you as an individual are receiving less per hour than was originally negotiated, and you don't agree with us. You think that that's coming out of your paycheck, but we wanted to be side on the conservative side because what we're most concerned about is that there have been situations in the past, and there could be in the future, this kind of goes to your issue, Senator Larson, where there's an agreed-upon employer-paid fringe benefit that is all of a sudden put on the paycheck and treated as salary for pension purposes, yet the individuals are required to make a mandatory contribution towards something else that the employer used to make directly and now requires the employee to make out of the check. Okay? So we said to the unions, we'd like to see clarification in our salary definition that says for their particular arrangements, we can accept it as salary if the law says that it is salary for our purposes, but we'd like to add language that says when the contribution is from mandatory withholdings from the employee's wages at a minimum. Because then we make it clear that it isn't, say they negotiate a 3% raise across the board and the employer agrees to put $2,000 separately directly into the union pension fund, we don't want to see that $2,000 treated as salary for para purposes. We have other sections of our law that exclude that, but we don't want any confusion about that. So we wanted to tie something specifically to this special supplemental plan that the unions have and clarify that if the negotiations say they all have to take a reduction in their salary to contribute toward this employer contribution, we want that clear in the language of our law.
You have that? We'll Xerox it.
We have copies.
Well, we have copies. We have copies.
Okay. The one thing I'd like to clarify, Mr.
One
Chair.
Sec.
Okay.
On this language or something else?
On this language.
Wait till we get it. Thank you.
If I can ask a question, just to make sure we got the right language here.
Mr. Martin.
Ms. Vanek, what we're passing out is 05-202 is an amendment that was sent over late yesterday afternoon by Lance. Is this the language you're looking for?
Why don't we, Lisa, would
give
you
one to Mary Vanek, please?
Give them a copy.
That's okay.
Is that the language?
Yes.
Okay, Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair and members, in speaking with the individuals representing their interests here today, they're not particularly comfortable with the language on line 4 through the balance of this that says, and the employer certifies to the director that the contribution is considered salary. I think it is a bit redundant and that we could accept cutting off the amendment at wages, put in a period after or semicolon.
Cut it off on line 4.
Cut it off on line 4 at wages.
And the
drop and the in lines 5 and 6.
That's correct.
Yes, that is, we would concur with that. I think both of our goals is to make sure that, you know, our intent was to try to clarify and make sure that the law gave direction to the employers and didn't leave latitude for the employers to interpret.
So the amendment as it stands, the 202 now, would be lines 1 through 4 up to the word wages.
Period.
Questions by the commission?
Did somebody move that?
Well, first let's just make sure people understand where we're at here. And Ms. Vanek, I want to. Are you comfortable at this point, or do you think some more work needs to be done here?
Mr. Chair, after talking to our staff, we believe that this will suit the needs of the conflict that we had with the union groups as to our interpretation. I'm comfortable.
Okay. You know, and I want to make sure that you're not feeling that you're getting rushed into anything here. Okay. Okay. Representative Thiessen moves to the 202 amendment, which stops at wages. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed. Motion adopted. How about this retroactivity issue that the 49ers said that they would back off on? What's your sense of that, Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair, I'd prefer that it not be included.
Okay, and how do we accomplish that?
Members, the retroactivity that you're concerned about is in Section 3 of the bill. So on page 5 and 6, if you were to delete Section 3, you would do away with the retroactivity.
The whole section?
Yes. The section says that we're going to treat past contributions on supplemental plan contributions as salary, and this backs it up, in effect. It allows the payment of the equivalent contributions that would have been made.
Okay.
And you don't need any of the section.
So Thiessen moves to delete Section 3. Maybe he doesn't. All right. Betzel and no, Larson moves.
Betzel and Larson will move it.
Betzel and Larson move to delete Section 3. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed. Aye. Motion adopted.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Mr. Martin.
Members, you've covered most of the policy issues. I do want to flag that the change on page 4, line 34, this is the shift in the dollar amount of the maximum amount that would be contributed from $2,000 to $5,000, that if you do this, yes, you may take care of a possible demand or a request in the future to change this, but you will also presumably set off a chain reaction for those individuals. For instance, up on page 4, line 3, most public employees are covered by this provision with a $2,000 maximum, and you will get requests from other individuals to go presumably above $2,000. We don't have any good information about what the actual practice is in all of the states. It's not clear that all employers provide an employer match to a supplemental plan contribution, and where they do, for instance, the legislature does, but only to a very limited dollar amount, nowhere near the $2,000. But other units of government do provide matches, and potentially some of them are at $2,000 and may want to go above $2,000. So you have disparate treatment now with a $2,000 cap, and this will put pressure to increase that cap. So if you do it, just so you understand what you may be setting yourself up for future requests.
We've got one on line 3, it's $2,000. On line 20 for
Minsky,
it's $2,700.
Yes, members, I think that in Mr. Stanton, I see is jumping up, that does reflect some additional supplemental plan coverage that Minsky faculty members have had since 1965. And so that there's it's a $2,000 plus a rationale for why it's higher than $2,000. And Mr. Stanton, who probably remembers this cleaner than I do, may want to tell you why it's $2,700, if it matters.
You don't have to know the answer. If you don't know the answer, that's fine. Do you know why that there's a 2,700 limit at Minsky?
Mr. Chair, members of Russ Stanton, Director of Government Relations for the Interfaculty Organization. Just the supplemental, Minsky had a supplemental retirement plan that goes way back to 1967. At the time that in, I think, 1989, where they made these matching contributions to the state deferred comp plan, what they decided to do was, instead of creating another plan for the Minsky employees, that instead they set the contribution limits for the Minsky supplemental plan at 2,000 employer, 2,000 employee, just like they did for the deferred comp plan, and that's and our employees cannot contribute to the deferred comp matching plan the same way that other employees do. In other words, it's a substitute for it. What happened over the years is we negotiated supplemental retirement because it was tax deferred. It was a better form of compensation for us. We negotiated up, and as we got up to the $2,000 limit, we indexed it several years back for inflation, and it went up to $2,700.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks. Do the other funds?
It's not really a pension fund issue. It's really an employment issue. Pension funds may not know.
So who would care if that starts getting ratcheted up? The employer?
The policymakers, because of the disparate treatment.
But Ms. Martin said, "I'm sorry. Why should we care?" Or give us why we would want to think about whether we should care or whether others come in and ask for that to go up.
Members, the history of the the restriction on supplemental pension plans is set forth in the memo. But basically, since 1971, the legislature has put certain limits on what local government and other governmental units can do in setting up supplemental pension plans. Back in 1971, the supplemental pension plans were set up as a way to boost pensions when the statewide plans provided what was viewed as an inadequate pension. This was before the movement to the high five, when the statewide plans were still at a career average salary. And what we saw is in some jurisdictions, there was an end run around the statewide plan through the use of supplemental plans to get a larger benefit that wasn't being provided in other jurisdictions. The legislature's response in 1971 was to restrict, to not permit the creation of new supplemental pension plans. That was changed back in 1989 with the permission to create a supplemental pension plan using either the state deferred comp program or tax sheltered annuity programs, but a cap was placed on the maximum contribution that could be put into these supplemental plans. Again, presumably with the same idea that these could become vehicles that could overtake the underlying pension plan and become the dominant pension coverage and provide disparate pension coverage for folks who are similarly in similar circumstances in, you know, adjoining school districts or adjoining our municipalities. So we have had the policy of a cap with a certain dollar amount. The $2,000 amount is the 1989 dollar amount.
89.
It's never been increased.
And it started at 2,000?
It started at 2,000 and it's never been changed.
And Mr. Chairman?
If you do change it, you run the possibility of other jurisdictions wanting to pursue a larger amount.
Senator Larson?
That was, Mr. Chairman, that was back when we had Dr. Franklin Smith as our commission actuary, and that was his recommendation. And I have to be chairman of the commission way back.
His recommendation to have it at 2,000 or to actually move in to allow this?
No, to limit it because, okay. You know, they were, that's before we had the high five, and they were finding ways to kind of skirt the limits.
Mr. Pufo, give.
Yeah, I guess that is why I felt it was important for me to talk about our intent and the history of this and what our goal is. Again, you know, the specter of you know, 65-year-old arborists and tree trimmers, you know, is probably not something that's going to benefit our employers as well. So, again, you know, our goal is to, you know, take advantage of the opportunities that we have within our local union pension funds and our national pension funds to have our members be, you know, situated and able to retire, you know, before becoming a liability to the employer. I would also, you know, reiterate that in those other plans with those caps that you are referencing, the total contribution towards those investments, which are risky, where these are known, you know, are $5,400 in total or $4,000 in total. So, you know, if I understand and concur, you may have other people that would look at this and say, well, we would also like those caps raised. But we are not asking for a contribution from our employers. We are taking money out of the wages that we negotiate and choosing to invest it to diversify our portfolio, so to speak, so that our members are situated and eligible to retire right before they become a liability to our employers. The pension, you know, benefits have changed dramatically, yet our work and our working conditions and the requirements of the people that do the work that we represent haven't.
So it's a destructive.
Right. Well, why don't we go ahead the way it is, but let's think about what Mr. Martin's pointing out is that on line 34, it does say employer contribution, even though the whole purpose of this bill is because there seems to be a slight difference here from the way that is normally thought about. So we might want to just think about whether there's a way to describe this cap differently, and maybe that's too complex. But
yeah, the other thing I would remind, I mean, the friendly amendment that we concurred with HERA does reiterate that these are wages, these are negotiated in lieu of wages or subtractions from wages. So, again, they are 100% employee funded.
So you're arguing that even though it says employer contribution, if you do it in the context of all the wording in there now, it's pretty clear that it's. Okay, well, should we just leave it the way it is and then just keep thinking about it a little bit? So. Are you comfortable with that, Cal?
Yep.
Okay. Okay, then Representative Thiessen moves Senate File 1682 as amended be incorporated. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion adopted.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Ms. Vanek. Ms. Senator Kelly, Senate File 1865. Mr. Martin.
Members, the bill here, Senate File 1865, tries to address the question of portability among teachers and school administrators in two ways. One is to provide authority for TRA to enter into an agreement with other teacher pension plans to provide something that's essentially identical to our internal combined service annuity that we have within Minnesota, but to do it interstate. And the other is to allow school administrators to be in a plan, be in the MNSCU IRAP plan rather than TRA. They have defined contribution plan coverage for their service in Minnesota, much like we permit city managers to not be in PERA but be in the International City Management Association defined contribution plan. I think with this, I think Senator Kelly can better address the problem he's trying to solve, and then I can get involved as you have questions.
Senator Kelly.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you very much. The reason I got drawn into this is that after conversations with Mr. Kite and some superintendents, especially people who have been involved in superintendent searches, we have more and more school districts have been engaged in searches for superintendents and have started to develop some limitations on the pool of applicants, especially where they were seeking a nationwide pool of applicants, people who were concerned about their ability to transfer pension credit accumulated in another state if they were going to come to Minnesota. At the same time, we've been losing some superintendents to other states where the ability to transfer some credit is accepted, or there's some mechanism for it. And so from my perspective, it was appropriate to come up with some ideas to try to make it easier for Minnesota school districts, if they choose to hire administrators from other states, as well as to recognize the fact that we were experiencing some drain of our superintendents to other states. I had a conversation with Mr. Martin about the what I saw as the need, and he recommended a number of options, and the bill before you has two of the options. One is to permit the participation in a defined contribution plan rather than in the defined benefit plan. And the other is, as he said, the potential to negotiate a sharing arrangement with other states so that if administrators are hired from those other states, they could take advantage of a sharing arrangement. Now, the second thing is potentially a good idea in order to deal with some of these interstate transfer issues, but it does depend on the willingness of the other state entities to participate in an agreement, which is the reason that you have two options. One could create a more effective structure if there are multiple states who want to participate. The other gives a superintendent or administrator an individual election depending on his or her circumstance in trying to figure out what works. And I know that there are concerns among the plans. As I was learning more about this issue, TRA and to some extent some of the other plans expressed concern about expanding the defined contribution participation option, and they expressed to me that they thought that the purchase of service credit authority that had been in place in the past was actually a better solution than the ones I was proposing in this bill. So, but I know that the commission had moved away from that. So the bill doesn't include that, but I do have amendments that could be offered if the commission feels that the most effective way of addressing the issue would be to restore the ability of an administrator or a broader category of teachers to purchase service credit to address this challenge involving moving administrators from another state to Minnesota. So, Mr. Chairman, really the Pension Commission, I'm putting before the Pension Commission several options, and I have some witnesses who can explain further the need for action at this time.
Mr. Kite.
Senator Pogemiller and members of the committee, we're going to try to be real brief. Our concern is that we need to find a way to have as wide a pool of people to take these leadership jobs as possible. And we're finding that we're really struggling to have that happen. And we're doing a number of things to develop principles to move into the superintendency and try to do a whole number of things to increase the size of the pool. Our challenge is the larger districts. Between this year and 2 years out from now, that'll be a period of 3 years, we're going to lose, by our surveying, 70% of our metropolitan area superintendents. And those are very complex jobs that are going to turn over. And we're not sure we're going to get people for those jobs. And we know that most of them will have to come from Minnesota. But we're hoping that we can find a way to attract a few from other states. And secondly, for those people we have that had prior service in other states and are now serving in Minnesota, who are doing a really good job in those superintendent or lead roles, we're hoping that we can hang on to them. And that's why we've been working with Mr. Martin and TRA and Senator Kelly trying to find some possible solutions to try to encourage more applicants to apply from out of state and hang on to the people we have. So with that, we have Superintendent Ted Blazing is here, and Board Chair Dale Festi from the Hopkins District is here. Ted Blazing is the superintendent at White Bear Lake.
Good morning,
Superintendent. Your tenure, you've outlived your half-life out there.
Just about. This is year 13, Senator Pogemiller, and I with pride continue to serve the community and our school district, and looking forward to another 3 years serving in that same capacity, as a matter of fact.
The reason I say that is I think it's about a 3 or 4 year half-life, isn't it, for superintendents nowadays?
Pretty close. Yeah, pretty close. So, we've exceeded the norm, a few of us. As noted, I serve with pride as superintendent of schools in the White Bear Lake Area School District. However, recently I've also started to assist the firm of Hazard, Young & Atiyah, a superintendent search firm, to recruit and hopefully make a good match with a superintendent and a school board. Recently, we've concluded searches in such places as St. Cloud, St. Louis Park, Osseo, North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale. We're in process in South Washington County. Let me talk for just a moment about some things that we're experiencing. First of all, over the past 20 years, Hazard, Young & Atiyah has done over 500 superintendent searches across the country. We're finding the number of applicants is dropping exponentially. 10 years ago, for example, in South Wash, we would estimate that we would have had 50 to 60 applicants for the superintendent's position. We had 20. I personally talked with two top-level superintendents, high-performing, recognized as leaders within their states. During that conversation with them, I told them, before you finalize your application, you need to go to the TRA website, look at the calculators, consider what that might mean to you and your career and perhaps the next 30 years of your life beyond working as a professional. They did that, called me back, and for two different reasons chose to withdraw from the search. But both reasons were related to their post-retirement benefits and looking at the impact of that over time. We're aware of other states where it's easier to buy years of service or to have some other option than simply moving in and starting fresh again as a seasoned professional, as a superintendent. With that, I'll turn to my friend, the board chair in Hopkins.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dale Festi, and I'm the current board chair in the Hopkins School District. Today I'd like to briefly just leave you with a couple of points. My first one being very specific to the Hopkins School District. Dr. Michael Kramer, our superb superintendent, whom many of you perhaps know, will be forced to return to Wisconsin to finish out his career due to the present pension system and its lack of portability. So our issue as a board in Hopkins is one of our inability to retain an excellent leader due to forces beyond our control. Strong superintendent leadership throughout the history of the Hopkins schools has contributed greatly to its excellence. And I would comment on Senator Pogemiller's early comment about half-lives of superintendents. There's kind of an amazing statistic in Hopkins. Since 1950, Hopkins has had four superintendents. So it speaks to the quality of the leadership that we've had there. My second point is the issue of attraction. It's already becoming painfully obvious that top-notch candidates from beyond the borders of Minnesota are not applying and cannot be recruited, as Dr. Blazing stated. So in Hopkins, again, we may be losing twice, losing a highly talented leader and selecting a new leader from a narrower pool of candidates. I believe it's only fair for any school board to be able to attract and retain the best leaders we can find to lead our schools. We need pension changes for superintendents that will allow us to remain competitive with other states. Thank you.
Thank you. Could you just articulate without, breaking too many, give us a general circumstance. Why would a superintendent who's been successful in Minnesota need to consider moving back to a different state because of their pension?
Mr. Chairman, Superintendent Kramer spent most of his career first as a teacher in Wisconsin and then as an administrator. He was hired from Wisconsin by the Hopkins School District about 12 years ago. He started his job the same time I came to the legislature, so it was about 12 or 13 years ago. And because he can't transfer that pension service to Minnesota, if he wants to finish out at a high enough level, he would have to go and get a high-level job back in Wisconsin.
Not have to, but it's a significant incentive to do that.
Mr. Chairman, that's an accurate description.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Kelly, did he apply to buy back during those years that we could have bought back?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Murphy, my understanding is that he did not, and I did not ask him why not.
Let's try to take it away from an individual superintendent and just talk in general. What someone had an opportunity to buy back in a similar circuit they could have purchased back, Mr. Martin?
Yes, members, there was general authority for 5 or 6 years to purchase prior service credit, service in another state, in another country, in private schools, parochial schools. Only 0.6% of the TRA membership utilized the buyback. We had TRA look at school administrators. They couldn't identify superintendents only, but they had a category of school administrator. And only 10% of the people who did buy back service credit were school administrators, and their service credit purchase was very, very short. One-third of them purchased less than 1 year of service credit, and only two of them, if I remember correctly, purchased 5 or more years. So when we did have authority to purchase service credit, very few purchased any sizable quantity, and they could purchase up to 10 years of service credit.
And would that have potentially been just a small pool of people that would have needed to do that, or just really expensive?
TRA may be able to give us a better understanding of how big the pool is or not. It is very expensive to purchase service credit. And when
a
school
higher your salary,
because of the higher salary and because of the length of service and the large pension benefit that they would obtain by getting the extra service credit, makes it very, very costly. And they're purchasing a very long time, typically after they've served that service.
Dr. Blazing.
Senator Pogemiller, members of the commission, I explored that very option twice. As a matter of fact, had estimates made and presented to me by TRA to purchase back years of service. And it was simply cost prohibitive. It was incredibly expensive to purchase each year, and when you look at multiple years, it becomes cost prohibitive. And quite candidly, when you do the fiscal projections, you say, I don't know if that really pays off for each individual to invest that type of money, purchase years of service.
Can you give cost prohibitive, what kind of dollars, roughly? Just general, don't give a...
Oh, golly. In my case, the purchase number of years I was looking at was six digits. It's a lot of money.
You don't have that just sitting in the bank account?
No.
TRA?
$20,000 per year of service
credit. Mr. Martin, while he's coming up.
Members, if I remember looking at numbers, it's not uncommon to be $20,000 per year of service credit for a regular school teacher, and presumably if you have a larger salary and a higher benefit, it's much larger than that.
Could be double that per year.
Mr. Thompson can actually tell us.
Mr. Thompson?
Mr. Chairman, no, I can't actually tell you, but it is very expensive because it's a very valuable benefit, and the closer you are to retirement, the more expensive it becomes. If you're a younger person and you're going to buy this service, it's less expensive. Luther Thompson speaking for TRA. So there are some issues there. It depends upon when you buy it. It certainly depends upon your salary. If you're talking specifically about a superintendent coming from out of state, presumably most of their service would have been prior, you know, teaching, then being a, you know, an administrator, and then coming here. So they probably have a large number of years of service. We do have a lot of administrators. We have about 2,700 administrators, I think, and most of those have service within a longer period of service than the average member in TRA. So they do have a lot of teaching service here in Minnesota.
Do or do not?
They do. So, you know, in that situation, I think the issue is, are we growing enough superintendents in Minnesota? That's beyond my expertise. The next issue really is portability with this whole issue. How do you address that? You have also the issue of, you know, if you have an individual member problem, do we want to turn the whole pension policy that we've developed here in the state sort of on its head in a matter of minutes? I think we need to, you know, look at this, you know, in a little more detail.
I think you might want to give the commission a little more credit than that.
Right. But you
we'll
see,
spend at least half hour.
And we have Mr. Kite is correct. TRA has had discussions with Mr. Kite, you know, about alternative options, and we've discussed these. The one issue we really do have with this bill came up with this multi-state CSA approach that has never been addressed before with us, and I think that is really problematic. So within the bill, that's our whole Section 2 in this bill that we would strongly recommend be deleted, because we're certainly willing to look at this and study it and research it, but it's simply premature to go into to implement all of these requirements.
CSA is Cooperative Service Agreement?
Combined Service Annuity.
Combined Service Annuity.
We do have that with the three major pension funds in Minnesota. But if we're going to go and look at Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, and the other 50 states and the multiple options within those states, we don't know what the cost is. And within those provisions, it expects that we're supposed to, on an annual basis, go over and try to determine what the net additional cost or benefit to TRA is. Many of these costs would not be determined until years later when the person is retiring. So we do have some problems with that. We're willing to look at it. We're willing to work with the commission staff. We're willing to go to Wisconsin, talk to those folks, and find out if there's any interest there. No one has ever approached us about that particular approach. We do think there are other possibilities. Certainly, if you know, portability is an issue. Purchasing of service is an alternative. We did have problems with that before. We had disagreements over the methodology. We have a new commission actuary now that could perhaps look at that and try to verify what is the right approach. It is certainly more expensive if you're going to be a person that has the rule of 90 versus not having the rule of 90. And so there's a number of serious policy issues that have to be dealt with there. The other issue was, once you started to allow people to buy prior service, you ended up with an infinite number of categories of prior service. I mean, you could possibly have, a 5-year, you know, the IRS allows you to buy up to 5 years of airtime if you're going to pay the full actuarial value. That's another thing. And that actually would benefit people coming from additional state where they probably have service that is covered that they wouldn't necessarily want to buy in Minnesota. So I think there's a number of options to look at. Senator Kelly has talked to us about some of his amendments, and we are supportive of some of those. But if you have any specific questions about this issue, I'd be happy to answer them.
Senator Larson?
Mr. Chairman, well, you know, the purpose of our pension plans is to reward the long-term committed employee from within the state. That's always been my philosophy when I was on the commission years ago. So it just kind of bothers me that we've got 60,000 teachers in the state, and I'd like to ask Mr. Kite, you've got, what has the Superintendents Association been doing to train additional people for these jobs? I can't believe when we've got one of the best public education systems in the states that we have to go out and recruit around the country when we've got all kinds of talented people within the state of Minnesota. And why the superintendent from Wayzata came here in the first place, I question that because he doesn't like apparently our pension plan, and now you want to change it for him. But I get a little disturbed with the fact that the superintendent.
No one's talking.
Hopkins. Whatever.
Well, Mr.
I don't think he's complaining. I think that Senator Kelly and others are just kind of.
But my whole point is, Mr. Chairman, is that we've got 60,000 teachers and I don't know how many administrators in the state. And we have to go out and recruit around the United States for potential leaders. We got lots of great potential leaders in the state.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just address that, Mr. Kite could chime in. Mr. Chairman, Senator Larson, a couple points. As our districts have become more diverse, particularly in the metro area, but not just in the metro area, school boards have deemed it advisable to seek candidates who are racially or ethnically diverse. And given our legacy of being somewhat less diverse than we are becoming, many school districts have sought African-American superintendents from outside the state. St. Louis Park did that. Superintendent Barbara Pulliam was a great addition to the St. Louis Park school district for a period of time. And now she left Minnesota to go serve in Georgia. We benefited. The state benefited. Our kids benefited from having Dr. Pulliam here for a period of time. And if we could have hung on to her, I would have been very pleased, and especially if she could have, you know, moved up to a bigger district than St. Louis Park. So that's one reason, paying attention to our ability to recruit superintendents from outside the state is very important. And I was in a conversation on the salaries and the salary cap for municipal officials, and I was being asked by rural members about, gee, aren't you just going to make it easier for metro area cities to hire people away from greater Minnesota cities? It strikes me that if rural districts are concerned about a brain drain from rural areas to the metro area, expanding the pool from which metro area districts can seek candidates is beneficial to everybody in Minnesota to reduce the pressure on greater Minnesota districts. I totally agree with what Mr. Kite said earlier. We got to train our own leaders, but we also have to see this as being part of a broader pool. We have a situation where city managers have portability, because so we have city managers that come in from outside the state, they leave. I think that's a good thing for our cities to bring new ideas and from different parts of the country, and that issue doesn't exist for city managers because they have a mechanism for portability that superintendents don't have.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we also have the drain from the metropolitan areas that want to come out and enjoy the great quality of life that we have in greater Minnesota, too. So they're coming out because they like what we're doing out in the countryside. So may I ask Mr. Kite about what your programs are when we've got all these talented people in the state of Minnesota and we have to go out to other states to recruit? That doesn't make any sense to me.
Senator Larson, members of the committee, I'll try to give you a relatively brief answer. We're doing a number of things. First of all, we're having good success moving principals up into superintendencies. We are working with the principals associations. They get a little angry at us, by the way, because they perceive us as stealing their people. But at the same time, we are doing workshops in their association meetings, telling them about the opportunities of being a superintendent and where the gratification and, frankly, where the challenges are. We're doing quite a bit of that. We're also encouraging school boards to look more at growing their own people. In fact, I can just share with you that we're just finalizing contracts right now in the Stillwater District and the Grand Rapids District, where their principals are moving up to take over their superintendency, and I could name more than that. A couple of challenges we have, though, is with these larger suburban districts. Our mid-sized districts across the state and our regional centers and the mid-sized districts out on the edge of our suburban area, we're having a very difficult time convincing those superintendents to move into the larger suburban districts. And secondly, their boards in those communities don't want them to move and are doing everything they can to hang on to them. In a way, that's good because those communities get to continue to have quality superintendents as well. But it's hard to get people for the pool of these large districts. In a way, as Senator Kelly said, that pool is almost more an upper Midwest or even a national pool. The people who come to the districts like Robbinsdale and Osseo and Brooklyn Center and Edina, there's a fair chance that your best group of applicants are people that are serving in districts like that in another part of the country. And that's where our real challenge is lying right now.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative
Smith. Senator Larson spoke of on the attraction argument for doing this, that you have to look elsewhere to find competent or qualified administrators, superintendents. There are 60,000 teachers in the state and 2,700 administrators. Senator Kelly, you countered with an argument that because of diversity, you may have to look elsewhere. I don't know that. I guess that argument is not convincing that you would have to look other than within a pool of 60,000 Minnesota teachers to find someone to qualify under a diversity argument. We heard Mr. Thompson, Mr. Chairman, speak about the problems with combined service annuity, that it's a premature idea, that it don't know what the cost would be. Serious policy issues, the desire perhaps to work with staff for a bit of time, maybe go to Wisconsin and discuss the issue. I don't know, this bill, this proposal sounds like interim study material to me.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I totally agree with Representative Smith, and I think it should get a House file number too. And I think many of the subjects that we touched upon are worth hours and hours of debate, because as Mr. Kite said, they're going down into the principal's group and the principals are saying, don't try to steal us. But Representative Smith just talked about our excellent pool of teachers. In my opinion, the very, very best of teachers should be encouraged to stay in the classrooms, and the very, very best of the principals should be encouraged to stay in as principals. And because they're the ones that are succeeding with the kids and the communities in our as they are now, and there should be a whole different group of people encouraged to become superintendents. And if we have to get them from someplace else, fine, but bring them in as young people, not as successful teachers that became principals, that became superintendents, and now are coming to Minnesota for their last years their career. We should start encouraging 25-year-olds to be out there applying for superintendent jobs and becoming superintendents and training as superintendents, fiscal managers of our communities. The very best of the teachers aren't trained as fiscal managers, and that's what we need in our communities. And so we have to talk about a lot more of that in our retirement programs. We have to talk about the whole concepts, and I'd be willing to spend hours on that topic because I really have lots of opinions.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I agree with what Representative Murphy says, and I think Representative Smith is right. I think this is takes some interim study, and that's it. I'd like to move that.
Well, let's just slow down 1 sec. Senator Kelly, you have some amendments you want the commission to at least look at?
Mr. Chairman, I do.
You have copies?
I do.
Why don't we just get them out here and let people cogitate this stuff for a while? We'll wrap it up here today pretty quick.
Mr. Chairman, while the amendments are coming around, let me just comment on the agreement with the other states. It doesn't require the TRA to do anything. All it does is allow the TRA to enter into those kinds of conversations. So there's nothing mandatory about it. And if the TRA has those discussions and no agreement is reached, that's consistent with the way the bill is written. The bill as written does not relate actually to, nothing in the bill as written really solves the individual problem that Mr. Festi mentioned. My purpose in bringing the bill is to solve the broader problem. If I could keep Dr. Kramer in my district, I would. Senator Larson and Senator Murphy, regardless of the fact that he started out as a teacher and worked his way up as an administrator, and what we're saying is that we'd like these to be his final career years in Minnesota rather than create a situation where economically he feels he has to leave. Representative Smith, we don't have enough African-American teachers in our classrooms. We don't have enough African-American principals. We don't have enough Hispanic teachers and Hispanic principals in our classrooms. So if in order to jumpstart role models for our kids and for our teachers and for our administrators by hiring some people who've already been successful in other states, I think that's okay. I think that's a good thing to do. But the Education Committee is constantly struggling to find ways to promote the development of teachers who reflect the diversity in the classroom. We've created urban educator programs to try to expand people who know the techniques but are also reflective of the communities that are being served in our urban schools. And we have a lot more work to do on that, but we still have a shortage there. So when I understand the point about the total number of teachers, but I think we have to look at some of the specifics in order to understand the need I was trying to describe with respect to the diversity of our administrators.
Why don't you just quickly tell us what these amendments are? So,
Mr. Chairman, the A1 amendment was requested by the TRA. The concern, as I understand it, is that if we go down the road of offering a defined contribution approach, they would like that to be as narrow as possible so that we aren't upsetting the general commitment to a defined benefit plan that is our Minnesota pension approach. So they ask that we do something to limit the number of applicants who might be eligible for that defined contribution. And this says that the applicant has to make the election within 1 year of coming to Minnesota. And secondly, that it's only a school administrator who had become a school administrator outside the state. So it's an effort to respond to concern that the TRA had raised.
Is the way your bill is structured, is the defined contribution piece, is that a supplement or is that a alternative to? It's an alternative?
Mr. Chairman, they could be in parallel. So you could do both. So
it's a supplement. It's not an alternative. Mr. Martin?
No, members, the way the bill is drafted, this would be an alternative coverage. You would be in the defined contribution plan instead of TRA.
Mr. Chairman, and I might have misunderstood the question. The commission could pass both Sections 1 and Sections 2, and they would operate, they would work in parallel. An individual, if they weren't covered, say, by the agreement, if there was an agreement with another state, an individual who wasn't from one of those other states could elect under Section 1.
Okay, A2.
Mr. Chairman, the A2 amendment would restore the purchase of service option under the formula that had been in existence just before that option terminated.
Okay.
And that's for, this would be for all teachers. And then the A3 amendment is limited just to superintendents.
Okay. We'll set this aside for members to think about. I just point out that half of this is only an idea that would go into effect if somebody came into an agreement. Two states came into an agreement, basically. And the other part, the defined contribution part, is not dissimilar to what we do for IRAP for some MNSCU employees. And so there may be good reasons not to do this now, but it's not that this is not a radical thing that's being talked about here relative to what we've done in other areas. And I think, I would just observe that I think a lot of issues kind of percolated up during that discussion. And we might want to just kind of, crank it back a hair.
Mr. Chair, I might suggest that if we are considering that similar issue to IRAP, though, that we have other bills here that IRAP's asking, or the MNSCU teachers are asking for a 5-year window rather than a 1-year window. And so as we're thinking about that, then this should probably be given more time.
Ms. Fuhrer, Mr. Kite, do you want to make a last comment, and then Ms. Fuhrer?
Yes, Senator Pogue, members of the committee, just a parting comment is that the great majority of the administrative leaders in the state will come from Minnesota. They'll come from the ranks of Minnesotans. But it would help if we had the ability to slightly expand the pool so that we could have some opportunity to attract a few more people from out of state, and also an opportunity to have those few people that are from out of state previously stay here in Minnesota. And that's really what we're asking for with these couple of ideas. Thank you.
Ms. Fuhrer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the commission. Cheryl Fuhrer representing Education Minnesota. First of all, I'd like to compliment the senator, for Senator Kelly, for bringing this forward. I do think that we need some portability for superintendents and assistant superintendents, so we do agree with the narrow definition. Secondly, I think as we look at the challenges facing superintendents and their jobs today, it's really different than the world that we lived in maybe 5 years ago even, but for sure 10 years ago the world was different. The challenges are very difficult, they're very hard, and we do need high quality leadership in these positions. And sometimes the only way to do that is to search wider than the state of Minnesota. I agree totally with Representative Murphy. Most of our teachers did not get into teaching to become superintendents, and we want to keep our best and brightest in the classroom. So that really is an issue that I think, that isn't really the answer to the issue brought before you today. In addition, the cities of the first class are not included in the current proposals. And even though their superintendents seem to be somewhat stable today, that will maybe become an issue again in the future. So I would suggest if you do work on this over the interim, that we make it inclusive of the cities of the first class, because I think also there's some issues there. Again, I think it's good to have this discussion on portability. It's necessary for superintendents, and I think it's something that would be of great value to many of our school districts across the state. So with that, I just thank you for the opportunity to make a statement.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Wardlow?
I just have a comment. I can understand and empathize with the need for this, but I also empathize with a lot of teachers who don't have the Rule of 90. That costs the TRA a lot of money also, and I understand Minneapolis teachers have a serious problem, and that's going to cost TRA and other people some money. So I think waiting and discussing this issue further to see exactly what it's going to cost everybody is a good idea.
Okay. Sir Kelly?
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the Commission's consideration of this. I agree with the comment you made that in attempting to develop the pieces of this, we tried not to be radical in the proposal to try to build on some precedents that existed already. But I understand that this is perhaps a new issue for the Commission. I would really appreciate if the Commission would act on it this year. But if not, I would hope that interim doesn't mean interminable.
No, just serving on the commission is that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, when I heard Senator Larson talking about his experiences some time ago, I wondered about that.
Well, Senator Larson, Senator Kelly, we'll keep chatting, work with TRA a little bit, talk to maybe some of the members, and I think we're still here. Members, thank you very much, Dr. Blazing. Thank you very much. I think there's about 46 bills that haven't been heard yet. I think seems like the best way to proceed is, and I don't know which days we're going to meet next week, but we'll get something out of here. It's a growing document. Not all of us were in the room, but the staff keeps putting a growing document here of what we've accomplished. And members should continue to review that, and stakeholders should continue to review that because, there's plenty of time to tinker with that before we go to the legislative committees also. And, next week we'll process something, 50 pages or whatever, and we'll get that to the committees. And then I think we'll probably still be working after that deadline to see if there's not some major issues that we can move as a group. But we'll certainly move a lot of the things that there's pretty good consensus on, get that to the committee, meet the deadlines, and then probably continue to try to do some work on larger issues if we can. So, does that make sense?
Should we count on next Friday then?
I think we'll be here next Friday, yeah. We'll try to figure out some time during the week also. And the way I scheduled these first bills was I basically went through and said, okay, what are the things that, we think we could move forward on that won't take a lot of time? We're now starting to get into bills that are going to take some more time, but if there's something left on this list that you think we should process that's not that big a deal and I just haven't identified yet, let's get that going. Staff wanted to mention that on the website.
Members, on the website there is a directory or a compendium of all the pension bills that are in play this session. And we also we keep a hard copy, and we could send a hard copy to your offices, which would give you a sense of all the bills that are around if you want to.
We'll email a hard copy, and with an instruction of how you can, or your staff can look at the website also. They keep it daily, they keep it up to date and so forth. So that just gives you a sense of what's there, what's not. Okay?
I just want to make it clear. I'm not going to send in hearing requests on all the bills I've introduced, okay? If I've introduced them, I'm assuming they're in play. So, because everybody's
right. No, I'm not operating off of that.
Everybody's bugging me to get hearing requests in. We're getting writer's cramp. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. No. I always work off the presumption that if it was good enough to have been introduced, someone wants to hear it. If someone doesn't want to hear a bill, please let me know because then we don't even have to worry about whether we're going to schedule that. If you've got a bill in that's not ready for prime time, just let me know and we won't even think about that one. I don't know if we're going to get through all the bills. We'll do the best we can here, but. So, okay, meeting adjourned. Thanks. Good work today.